It feels like I haven't talked to you, gentlemen, for 7 days.
It definitely hasn't been 48 hours. Definitely not.
It has been exactly 7 days since we last spoke, allegedly, and boy, there sure was a lot of news 7 days ago. So I think we should talk about that now.
I think that sounds like a good idea. Are we doing any sort of pre-show, or are we just going to skip that?
I think that was the pre-show.
Oh, son of a... So we're going to start with some follow-up, and Alvy Stoddard writes in, there's an Apple support document entitled About Secure Boot, where it says, and I'm quoting, full security is the default secure boot setting, offering the highest level of security. And this was it with regard to the T2 chip, the liquid metal chip that is in the iMac Pro, and it is the thing where it will only let you boot stuff that Apple signs in quasi- not really at all accurate summary. So which one of you guys put this in here? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I'll just put it in there because are we pretending that we're recording this, not recording this 2 days after the previous show? Because we didn't have a lot of follow-up, and this is a straightforward follow-up. We didn't know what the default was. Apple told us.
We got a lot of follow-up 7 days ago about this, and we wanted to talk about it.
It's interesting that the cranked-up security is the default one, because remember, the full security setting was the one that doesn't even let you boot if you have an old version of the OS. And I'm having a hard time figuring out who would find that behavior desirable other than people who have a bunch of Macs, other than enterprise people. And, you know, my old definition of enterprise software, of like the people buying the software and other people using it. Well, an enterprise situation is where the people deciding how the computers work are picking things based on how easy it is for them to manage the computers, not based on how nice it is for the people who have to use the computers to use them. But even in an enterprise scenario, enterprise people don't want their computers automatically updating without them having extensively tested that every single piece of software on them is compatible with it. So I don't know. Apple phrases this as being like the iPhone. Oh, it's like the iPhone, all this, you know, physical security, so much stronger than the old just firmware password. Now it's like an iOS device. But iOS devices don't refuse to boot unless you update. I mean, they're pretty naggy about it, telling you, hey, there's a new update. Look at this red badge on your settings app. But they don't actually force the update on you. And that's not misunderstanding how the full security works. But anyway, when Marco gets his Mac Pro, he will be able to confirm this default. And then I suppose, like, just wait for the first dot release of High Sierra to come out and then reboot and see if it demands that you update. You'll be a good guinea pig, right?
Well, a lot of this remains to be seen. But one thing I misunderstood about it that I've seen, it seems like their language is such that they're not necessarily requiring you to have the latest. They say that they can prevent you from booting versions that Apple no longer trusts. So I think what that could mean, and this is not from PR, this is just from things I read on the internet. What that probably means is, like, if there's a version of the OS that is an older version that security holes were discovered in, and somebody tries to, like, you know, boot that maybe or install over your OS with that so they can get to your stuff, maybe that's what it's preventing, which is a legitimate security concern. Because I can't imagine, like, if it's actually just like whatever is telling it, hey, the newest version is, you know, 10.13.7 or whatever. First of all, what mechanism does it even learn about that from? That's one question. But if it, you know, assuming that the secure boot enclave protection unit, whatever, you know, whatever's enforcing this, assuming that doesn't like the version you're running, I can't imagine it would just, like, brick your computer. Like, it's probably about preventing you from rolling it back.
It's not going to brick it. It's going to download the update.
Yeah, but so your computer can download updates without you approving it?
Like when you boot, it will download the update before, like, as part of the initial boot procedure. Like, oh, I'm gonna boot, but wait a second, I gotta do an update first. And so it'll know from the internet what the latest version is. It will know from the internet all the information about, like, this is the advantage / whatever of having a whole other CPU that, you know, that there is a boot procedure to boot up the T2 chip. And that's the thing, going to the internet, looking up all this information, downloading the software update, applying it to your computer, so on and so forth. But your idea about the fact that it's not just like it has to be the latest, but that it's only in cases where Apple says there's some version that we absolutely don't want anyone running, that would make more sense to me. Because if they do like a point release where they fix like a bug in Mail or something, you don't want the thing to force that update. Or like an update from Sierra to High Sierra, like, presumably the very last version of Sierra, whatever it was, 10.12.6 or whatever, doesn't have any terrible security flaws, so it wouldn't force you to download High Sierra when you boot. It would only force you to update if there was some terrible security flaw in the one you had. I don't know. We'll see. Or rather, you'll see, because you'll have this thing.
I mean, that's the only way that I can figure that this makes sense, because any other implementation of this, I think, would wreak havoc, and nobody would leave it on. Especially, like you mentioned, enterprise. Like, the last thing enterprise IT managers want is their computers forcing them to update their OS, like, without them doing it or approving it or testing it. Like, that's the last thing enterprise people would want. So I have to imagine this is about, like, just not letting, you know, law enforcement take your computer over and overwrite your OS with an older version that they have some tool that can hack and get your stuff. Like, that's probably what this is about.
But enterprise people do want you not to be able to boot their computers off of an external disk. They do want you not to be able to install, like, malware on their computers. Or people who have, like, if you're running a computer lab in a college and you have kind of public computers, a lot of these features appeal in that scenario of sort of protecting the computer from the outside. It's just, like, the final straw is, like, oh, and by the way, also, updates may be forced on you. And that is, you know, that's a bridge too far.
Yeah, I don't expect that this would be used to aggressively update, like, on day zero. I expect this would be to more aggressively force along the stragglers, to the point that, like, Marco, you're still on Sierra, not High Sierra, on most of your machines. Is that right?
On half of my machines.
How many machines do you have?
Oh, wait, no, I have the Mac Mini. Most of my machines. I forgot. Oh, I always forget about the Mac Mini because it's just like a headless server.
Wait, the Mac Mini still exists? Does it still work? Actually, at this point, if you had Secure Boot, it would probably refuse to start up because of its age. But anyway, I bring this up to say...
Maybe it would only run at a third of its performance because I haven't changed the battery.
Oh, God. Can we not talk about that? Anyway.
Oh, we're definitely talking about that. That was a huge deal 7 days ago.
It was a huge deal like 2 or 3 weeks ago, and everyone has been begging us to talk about it, and I really have no interest in it, but we'll talk about it. Anyway, The point is, I think at this point, you know, a couple of months on, this may be the time when a secure boot thing may start to compel you or try, or I guess I was going to say try, but I guess it would compel you to upgrade to High Sierra. But personally, I can't imagine if I were to get an iMac Pro or, you know, whatever computers come with this in the future, I don't think I would turn this from anything but full security. Like, I update not day zero or day one, if you will, but I update reasonably quickly. And I don't think that personally I would have any reason to crank this down. And it sounds like the two of you guys would. Marco, is that what you're saying, that you would not want to run it full security?
It depends. So I'm going to have to do some research over the next -3 to 6 days. But it has to be something more like preventing you from, like, overriding the OS with an old hacked version. It has to be. Like, imagine it's like, I can't imagine it's going to, like, I'm going to wake up my computer one day and it's going to say, nope, sorry, you can't run Sierra anymore. Like, I don't think that's going to be what they do, because that would just wreak havoc with so many, like, big installations and people's needs and everything. I can't imagine. So I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt and leave it on the default, which is the full security. And, you know, if I'm proven wrong in my research 3 to 6 days ago, then maybe I'll change my mind.
Yeah, I'm trying to look up, if I deleted from the show notes, the screenshot that Cable had posted, but my recollection of it is that it is different than the screenshot that it's on the Apple support document that we'll put in the show notes. And the wording underneath what full security means from Cable's screenshot, it was full security ensures that only the latest and most secure software can be run. Right, it requires a network connection and software installation, right? So that's the old wording. Only the latest and most secure software. Latest and most secure, I mean, is that just saying, like, the latest is always the most secure? But latest is pretty unambiguous. New text on Apple's page ensures that only your current OS or signed operating system software currently trusted by Apple can run. And that is very different. Very, very different. You know, so only your current OS, meaning whatever is currently on your system, or signed operating system software currently trusted by Apple. And that's more like what Marco was talking about. Currently trusted by Apple is Apple could say, okay, we put out a bum point release that is no longer trusted. So that particular one can't run, but any of these other 20 versions are all fine. So maybe Apple is changing its mind. I mean, I guess I would assume the one on the Apple site is the most up-to-date one. And I would assume that the text changes reflect the reality of the feature. But, you know, as we said, Marco will find out for us, I guess.
And I'd also like to reiterate what John, you had said a little while ago about any sort of larger organization wanting complete and utter control over their machines. At my work, which is a 500-employee company, I was put on the blessed list that I could install High Sierra, but by default, you are not allowed to install High Sierra. And my work is actually fairly hands-off with our machines. Like, by default, you know, average users do not get administrator privileges, but all developers do. And they're generally not too bad about giving us reasonably full access to our computers. And yet, despite that, we are not allowed to install upgrades of operating systems without, you know, them having blessed them and so on and so forth. And so they're kind of sort of beta testing with a group of, I don't know, 10 or 20 of us internally, of which I'm part of that. But a friend of mine works at a very, very large financial organization. And I've heard through this friend that their computer pretty much is inoperable. Their MacBook Pro is pretty much inoperable unless they are connected to the company's VPN or the company's Wi-Fi. Like, that's how stodgy these sorts of larger companies, especially in financial services, can get over time, is that this person's computer, they basically can't get to anything on the internet, even on their home Wi-Fi, until they've connected to Big Brother. I mean, to the company's VPN, so that they can be monitored. I mean, tracked. I mean, just taken care of. It's crazy out there, I tell you. Anyway, William Pierce writes in, there's a lot of women car journalists these days, but one blog that sprung to mind is at blackflag.jalopnik.com, and it's by Steph Schrader and Alex King. It's a great place for racing news, solid coverage, and they've gotten plenty of scoops. I have not had the chance to check this out. I've been pretty much off the internet all day. I'm assuming one of the two of you did, probably, John?
Yeah, this was but we had an Ask ATP question about, you know, car magazines for someone's kid. And I went into how a lot of the car magazines are written, as assuming that everyone who's reading it is a dude, and, you know, and how it's not really a great thing to introduce young readers to if you want them to avoid perpetuating, you know, sort of a behavior that excludes people or whatever. But the question was specifically about magazines, and I'm assuming the person meant paper magazines, because when I see magazines, that's what I think. But William brings up, you know, a good point. If you want to look for, you know, a more modern, inclusive take on whatever your hobby may be, online is probably the place to do it. And I do read some car sites. I watch more YouTube videos than I read car sites, but I certainly go to Jalopnik a lot, mostly led there by other people that I follow linking to cool car stories on Jalopnik. And so, yeah, they have, you know, blogs and journalists. And if you're looking for, it depends on what kind of news you're looking for. I looked at this thing, and it's a lot of racing news, and I'm really not into racing, but that's probably a better bet for finding new voices, as they say, in the automotive news industry.
We are sponsored this week by Casper. Start sleeping ahead of the curve. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/ATP and using code ATP at checkout. Casper continues to revolutionize its line of sleeping products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. Their mattresses are perfectly designed for humans, engineered to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Because they figure you spend a third of your life sleeping, so you might as well be comfortable. Casper mattresses provide all the support the human body needs in all the right places. They combine multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with just the right amounts of both sink and bounce, and a breathable design that helps you sleep cool and regulate your temperature throughout the night. All of these mattresses are designed, developed, and assembled in the U.S., and people love them, with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper's online store, Amazon, and Google. Casper is becoming the internet's favorite mattress. It comes in three models currently: the Casper, the Wave, and the Essential. And they also offer a wide array of other products to ensure better sleep, like sheets and pillows and stuff. All of this is kept affordable for you too, because Casper cuts out middle people and sells directly to you, the consumer. And all of this is very easy to get, because if you aren't completely satisfied, they offer no-hassle returns. It's delivered to your door, you can sleep on it for 100 nights, and if you don't like it, you can return it, no questions asked. Free shipping and free returns in the U.S. and Canada. There's really nothing to lose with Casper. I now sleep on a Casper, and I can tell you, it's great. Start sleeping ahead of the curve with Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/ATP and using code ATP at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Once again, that's casper.com/ATP, code ATP to get $50 towards any mattress. Thank you so much for Casper for sponsoring our show.
Let's do some Ask ATP. Scott Lougheed writes in, what do you think the odds are of attention detection on Apple Watch? It could really refine race to wake. Display remains on as long as you're looking at it, turns on with attention, etc. So quick recap on the iPhone, don't call it X. There is a feature by which if it realizes that you're not actively looking at the phone because it's using the front-facing like a camera array, if you're not looking at the phone, it will dim itself reasonably quickly. And if it's dimmed but still on, it will actually turn itself to full brightness again once it realizes you've looked at it again. And it's actually extremely cool. And so Scott's thought was, hey, could we use that same tech in the Apple Watch? So as you're looking at the Apple Watch, then it will continue to be full brightness. It won't ever turn itself off until it knows that you're no longer looking at it, at which case, obviously, it can turn itself back down or off or et cetera. To my eyes, like I do think that this will, on an infinite time scale, be a thing, but I don't see it happening anytime soon because even though they've taken what was effectively a Microsoft Kinect and shrank it down to be in the notch in the iPhone X, I don't see it becoming small enough to be on the Apple Watch anytime soon, much less having the battery power to power it. But that's just me. Marco, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it makes a lot of sense, honestly, because, you know, for all the reasons you said, like, I can't imagine that it would have the battery power to be constantly scanning to see if you're looking at it or not. And also for the feature of things like keeping the screen on for a while, if you are looking at it, again, it doesn't seem like it's worth the power. It doesn't seem like they have the physical space to put the sensors on the front of it. I don't think they intend for you to be looking at the watch without touching it for very long anyway.
All right, John, any other thoughts?
If they had the battery power to do the face detection, to power all the cameras and have them do all the things, they should spend that battery power on having a watch face that never turns off. I know it's probably different amounts, but like that's the goal. I think that's a better goal, like to basically get to the point where the watch face never turns off using whatever, better technology, better screens, whatever they have to do. That's what you want. And so this in-between thing where you burn a lot of battery energy trying to be super smart about when you turn the screen on and off seems like a bad trade-off to me.
Moving on, Max Velasco Knott writes in, I'm in the market for a RAID 0 external SSD storage. I'm wondering what you use and what you'd recommend. I'm on a Thunderbolt 2 machine, but I'm open to a backwards compatible Thunderbolt 3 drive if you happen to be using one. Thank you for any advice. I have precisely zero input on this, so Marco, take it away.
As mentioned 7 days ago, TIFF's iMac has had a 4-drive RAID 0 SSD Thunderbolt 2 enclosure for the last few years. So I have direct experience with these. They're fine. They're nothing special. They tend to come with really loud, crappy fans. I replaced the fan in hers with a much quieter Noctua super quiet fan, and that was a very, very good upgrade to do to it. That didn't seem to reduce the life of anything at all because it's really just cooling the very, very hot Thunderbolt chip that's inside. It's not really, you know, the SSDs don't need much cooling themselves. So it's fine. We've never had any problems with it, like, you know, disconnecting or failing or anything like that. But it is a fairly expensive solution. A much better solution if, you know, I don't know what Max's needs are here. But if you can at all avoid having an external RAID enclosure, you'll be better off for it if you can either just get like one big disk of some sort, or if you can use network storage like a NAS or something like that. Like, that's generally better. It's just less hassle and less crap and less, you know, less hardware to break and maintain. But if you still want to do this, the enclosure we got was from OWC, you know, maxsales.com. I think it was a few hundred dollars maybe for the enclosure. You know, anything involving multiple disk enclosures with a Thunderbolt interface is not going to be cheap. Another option that you have is to use the built-in software RAID in macOS. I know I don't think that applies to APFS yet, but is that right, John? Do you know?
What, do you want to know if you can do software RAID at all with APFS?
Yeah.
I don't remember. I remember have the same vague memory as you do that there was a bunch of limitations. I think they might have taken it away with APFS, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you can do software RAID still with whatever your file system needs are, another option you have, if the performance of this won't be too bad, is to just get a bunch of really inexpensive USB 3 enclosures. Because you can get a USB 3 SSD enclosure for like $15. I have a few of these from my own computer.
Bus powered. That's the important part. Bus powered.
Yes, and bus powered. Right, and because SSDs don't need external power, so that way you avoid having not only additional cable clutter, but also if you can eliminate some device's own power supply from your setup, you eliminate a major source of failure and weirdness. Because those little power bricks that come with everything are terrible. They just aren't very reliable. They fail all the time. Not to mention that they're big and bulky and ugly. So anything that can be bus powered is generally a gain for you here. And because you're powering SSDs and not big spinning disks, you should be able to get away with that. So if you can get away with just a handful of cheap USB enclosures, if that will work for your performance and throughput needs, that will be way cheaper and just a simpler setup in general. But it all depends on what you need. If you do still truly need an external RAID 0 enclosure, I've had totally fine luck with the OWC. I think it's called the Thunder Bay Mini or something like that. It's the one that holds specifically for 2.5-inch drives. It holds four of them. It's Thunderbolt from OWC, and it has a very loud fan until you put an Noctua fan in there.
Joshua Rogers writes, do any of you use any soundproofing or acoustic material in the room that you podcast in to help with audio recording quality? I will start. I used to, before I moved rooms on account of our forthcoming kid, I used to use literally a fleece blanket that I push pinned into the wall behind my iMac, and that was enough sound deadening to get the job done. Marco had told me very early on that I was echoing quite a bit, and this was probably during the neutral time, in fact, and something in 2013 or thereabouts, I push pinned this blanket to the wall and it stayed up for about 4 years until we moved rooms. Now we have some sort of soundproofing something or other that I think, Marco, you might have recommended, that I will put a link in the show notes.
Soundtracks Pro?
Maybe. I'll have to look through my Amazon order history.
If it has the cool swirly pattern, it's Soundtracks Pro.
No, definitely not. I probably got something considerably cheaper knowing me. So I will put links to both of these things into the show notes, and basically I have a panel of 9 of these. So let me back up a half step. So my iMac and my desk is in between two windows. Above the iMac is a panel of 9, I don't know, foot long by foot wide sound deadening things. And so there's basically the wall behind my iMac is all sound deadening material. There's nothing on the opposite wall because it's far enough away. Not that this room is that big, but it's far enough away that I don't think it really matters.
I wanted a link to the thumbtacks that you use that kept a fleece blanket on your wall for 4 years, because I'm just thinking of the idea of, I've got a fleece blanket that I want to hold on the wall. You know what I'll use? I'll use thumbtacks, or as Casey would say, pushpins. I'll use thumbtacks to put it on the wall. I would think within 5 minutes that thing would fall down. Did you use 100 of them, or are these the world's best thumbtacks?
No, it was not a terribly heavy nor thick fleece blanket. I'm sure I have a picture somewhere of it, but I don't know if I could dig it up easily. But it was not a very heavy blanket by any means. It was fairly thin.
Do you think you feel like it made a difference?
Well, Marco, I mean this in the most respectful way possible. Marco complained and moaned about my echoes, and then I put that up, and then he stopped complaining and moaning about my echoes. So either he figured out a way around it or it was better.
That's how I show my approval.
Yeah, exactly. When Marco stops complaining, he's happy. But anyway, Marco, tell me again what you have. You have Soundtracks,
TRAX Pro. They're, you can get them on Amazon. You get a decent sized pack for $40 or $50 with 8 1x4 foot sections, something like that. They also make larger ones. If you want to do a big wall, you can get larger panels that are about 2x5 or 2x4 feet. I have a few of those behind my computer. So this is the kind of thing. So it does help to treat the room with soft things to make you sound better. A lot of times people go a little overboard with it and they just kind of keep going because they think they need it, or it just looks cool. It makes you look like a really professional podcaster to have sound editing material, or, in your entire office. But usually you don't need as much of it as people use. And also, there's lots of alternatives that will work just as well. Your hanging a blanket on the wall was totally fine, because what you basically need is for the room to be filled with as many soft things as possible that can avoid echoes. That's what you're trying to avoid here is echo. You're not trying to insulate, like sound insulation to like make the room soundproof so that people outside the room can't hear you and that outside sounds can't get in. That's not what this is. That's a different thing. And you don't do that for $50. All we're doing here is trying to reduce the echoes of sound bouncing around hard surfaces of the room. And so some places just don't need this. Like one of the reasons why, like sometimes we joke, like when podcasters have to record like in our closets for some reason, it sounds great because closets are small spaces filled with soft clothing. So there's like there's no echoes that can be had. If you think about like the opposite, like the worst place you could record would be like in a bathroom, like with a hard floor and tile walls everywhere. Especially like if you ever like moved out of an apartment. And you've already packed up like the shower curtain and all your towels from the bathroom, so it's just totally empty. And you notice how incredibly echoey it is with no soft things in there. So we're going for the opposite of that. Like you generally just want soft things in the room. That doesn't have to be sound editing material. A rug helps tremendously, and you know just having blankets around. Like if you have like a giant open hard floor, put a blanket or a rug on it while you record. But the best thing you can do is as Casey mentioned with the blanket, the best place to put something soft is on whatever wall or whatever else is behind the microphone. Because if you think about how you talk towards a microphone, the first place that you're going to get those echoes is they're going to be bouncing off the wall behind the mic. Either, you know, your sound's going to go past the mic, bounce off the wall behind it, and then get fed back into the mic as an echo from the back or from the sides or whatever else. Anything you can do to minimize sound echoing from right behind the mic, you will see a large result from that. It can be sound absorbing material. If you're looking for something, you know, more like a permanent kind of setup that you can hang up and just leave there for years and be done with it, yeah, go for some kind of acoustic foam. And honestly, it doesn't really matter which acoustic foam you get. They're not very different. All you're looking for is like soft, squishy material to absorb the echoes. I like the Soundtracks Pro because it looks cool. It has this nice little like swirly kind of hexagon-like pattern. So that's kind of fun, but you know, it doesn't really matter. You can get pretty much anything at pretty much any price, and it'll work about the same. A second thing that you should consider if this is a problem for you, consider using a different microphone. A lot of microphones that come highly recommended on like gear guides and stuff and how to podcast and even come recommended from podcasters who just don't have a lot of experience with other microphones, a lot of them are inexpensive, large diaphragm cardioid condensers. This includes things like the Blue Yeti and a whole lot of entry-level microphones. Basically, if it's a condenser and you spent less than $200 for it, it's probably one of these. The problem with these, they do sound very nice and crisp, and they pick up a lot of detail in your voice, but they also pick up, like, if a pin drops in the room. Like, they'll pick up any background noise. And as a result, they also very, very easily pick up echo from the walls. If you just use a mic with a different pickup pattern, some people say you have to use a dynamic mic. This is not actually the case. You have to use a supercardioid mic. That's what you actually want. It can be a condenser or dynamic. It should be supercardioid or hypercardioid. What you're looking at, and I did a whole review. You can listen to audio samples. What you're looking at basically is the Shure Beta 87A. That's what you're looking at. It is about $250. It's an XLR mic, not a USB mic. I don't know of any USB supercardioid podcast microphones. If anyone knows of any, please let me know. But what this does, the supercardioid pickup pattern, it basically tightens and narrows the area from which it picks up sound. So it will pick up a lot less sound coming from different directions and coming from further away from the mic, which in turn will kind of inherently reduce the amount of echo it picks up. It's also really nice that it'll reduce the amount of background noise it picks up. Like if somebody, you know, breaks a plate in the next room over, like you'll hear a much quieter version of it than you would on a different pickup pattern, because the sound drops off further the more you go away from the mic. So anything you can do to narrow that pickup pattern, that will serve you very well in the mic, and then you won't need to do as much babying of the room.
Yeah, you know, it's really weird. I was using a Rode Podcaster for, I don't know, something like the first year that I was doing this with you two fine gentlemen. And then I am now using, what do I have? I don't have the 87A. I have the 58A. Is that right?
Yes.
I don't remember.
You should switch to the 87A, by the way.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I'll get to it at some point.
You sound good enough that I don't bother you about it.
And that's the Marco seal of approval. But it really is tremendous, the difference, because right now, you know, my mouth is within an inch of the pop filter, not the pop filter, but the foam on the edge of the microphone. And if I were to turn my mouth and maybe do something like 90 degrees the other direction, it is tremendous the difference that that makes. And if I go, you know, 180 degrees the other direction, you can barely even hear me. It's yeah. really crazy what a supercardioid,
yeah. And that's what you're using. Yeah, the Beta 58A is a supercardioid dynamic mic. It is very good for it's very good for the price. It's a little bit like boomy and fat in like the mid bass frequency area.
Yeah, it is. I mean, what?
Yeah, but for the price, it's pretty good. But I do recommend it. You know, if you have a setup that can take an XLR mic, and you can spend whatever that is, like $160 for that, save up another $80 and get the 87A instead. It's better.
Yeah, this is 160. You're right. And if you say the 87A is 60 more, then so be it. John, what is your situation with regard to sound deadening material?
John does not count. John has an inexpensive large diaphragm condenser microphone.
Not inexpensive. It was like $350 or something, wasn't it?
No. I think the most it ever cost was $250, but still. You have the Shure PG42 USB. It sounds incredible. It sounds very, very good, but it is an incredibly picky microphone for room dynamics because it's what I mentioned earlier. It's the kind that picks up like a needle dropping. Like, it picks up anything. However, all the rules of this microphone cease to apply in John Syracuse's office, and I don't know why, and I've never wanted to tell him to change anything, because for some reason that I cannot fathom or figure out, he sounds perfect all the time. He does not have any echo. There's never any noise or hiss on the track. All the problems that you would usually get with this type of condenser. And I bought that exact microphone to try in my Mega Review, and it was incredibly picky for me. But for some reason, it's perfect for John. So I don't, like, the rules do not apply in John's office.
Well, some rules do. I mean, so first, from the sound deadening material, for getting to this question, the main reason I don't have sound deadening material is back when we were all buying sound foam and stuff, of course, Marco bought the swirly one that he was just telling you about. And I'm like, oh, I should get that same swirly stuff Marco got. And I went to the webpage where they sell it, and it was $60. And my interpretation was, it's $60 for one rectangle of the foamy stuff. And then I looked at how many rectangles Marco has on his walls. I'm like, well, Marco, you know, all right, fine. But no way in hell I'm spending $60 times, you know, 12 to put foam on my wall. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I did some researching for cheaper foam, but I was just like, yeah, no, I'm just not going to do it. So anyway, now that I know that it is not $60 for one square, it's $60 for what? How many is it?
I think six or 12. It's enough. Like the $60 pack of the 1x2 sheets, whatever that is, that's enough for pretty much anybody to make their setup sound great.
Yeah, so that sounds more reasonable, although it really annoys me that the pattern doesn't line up if you buy all the squares. That really annoys me.
Yeah, and I have some of the big ones that I mentioned. It doesn't line up on them either, but at least with the big ones, you have fewer seams.
Yeah, so anyway, but I still don't have the foam. And also, I want to ask Marco how he attached it to his wall, and he's like, I permanently stuck it on there, and if I ever want to remove it, I have to repaint the wall. And I was like, eh.
Yeah, there's adhesive squares that they recommend that you use with it, and I got those. So each one of them is stuck on with something like six little 2x1 inch adhesive square things, like double-sided tape kind of things. And yeah, I'm pretty sure, and they haven't fallen off at all, which is great, but I'm pretty sure that's a pretty permanent installation.
That's it for the wall. You should have used Casey's thumbtacks.
Well, it's funny you bring that up. We tried to use command strips on the foam that we have, and they have all fallen over time. But I think if memory serves, I did get the adhesive squares that Marco recommended, and then we put those on the back of the foam and then command stripped those. Does that make sense? So it's foam, adhesive squares, command strips. And that actually seems to be holding pretty well so far.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You can put it right over the thumbtack holes if you have them. But anyway, as for my room, early on in this series, someone, I forget who it was, Marco, do you remember which one of the helpful audio people I'm about to talk about?
I believe it was Marcus DePaula.
Yes, there you go. That's probably it. sent us a bunch of advice about what we're doing, and what he had to say about my mic was that he heard a lot of echo, and he surmised that I had my monitor really close to my microphone, and he was right. And so the only thing I've done to make this room better for audio when I'm podcasting is I move my monitor farther away from my microphone, or my microphone farther away from my monitor. I still think the echo is there. It's just the delay is slightly different. The thing I think that's good about this room is, like, to my right is a giant bookshelf, and bookshelves are surprisingly good baffles for sound because of all the little knobbly books, you know, and the little gaps between them and behind them, and even my bookshelves where every spine is meticulously lined up. It helps if the spines are uneven. I bet it works even better. This room is carpeted, which also helps. And the windows do have blinds on them, which are also kind of knobbly. But yeah, it's nothing. And the gain is really low on my mic. And I have like tons of, I have a double pop filter and a foam shield on it. So I don't know. I'm dreading changing my setup, but I think I will eventually when I get my new computer in 20 mumble mumble. I'm going to have to, because anyway, I'm thinking
the new one
of getting
has USB.
Marco's recommended mic and Marco's recommended little hot box with knobs. And for my brand new computer, and then I'll just we'll see.
With knobs.
that's what I call those. Like, you can spend $750 for a hot box with knobs.
Yeah, it's actually up to like $900 now. The one I like is the USB pre-2 from Sound Devices. Like, so this is the box that converts USB to microphones. I've tried a lot of these things. There's lots of them that are totally fine for like $150. But I wanted something that was better than totally fine. I wanted something that was great. And Sound Devices USB pre-2 is great. It's the kind of thing that if you've ever had a problem or bad performance with one of the $150 ones, and you just get fed up and you're like, can I just throw money at this problem to make it go away? This is the answer to that question. The reason you should get it, John, is that it has amazing knobs. Like, all the other ones have cheap, crappy...
But I'm not supposed to ever touch the knobs.
No, well, you got to touch them, you know, a couple times to set it up.
Once,
and trust me,
never move them again.
You feel any other microphone interface's knobs, and you're going to be like, oh, God, my toaster's better than this. You try these knobs, and you're like, oh, my God, I want these knobs on everything I own. They're so much better.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I love you guys.
Anyway, I may eventually get something new, but we'll see. But that's it. No foam.
I love you guys so much. What is this show about? Knob feel. That's what this show is about.
We are sponsored this week by HelloFresh, a meal kit delivery service that is really convenient and really great. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter offer code ATP30. HelloFresh's meal delivery service shops, plans, and delivers your favorite step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. It works with your schedule, so you can choose which day you get your deliveries on, whatever works for you. If you're going to be out of town or you're not going to have time for a week or two, you can just pause your account and resume it whenever you want. All the ingredients come in pre-measured, handy, labeled meal kits, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. It's very, very easy to unpack, very easy to set up, and very easy to cook. HelloFresh offers a wide variety of options for you. These are chef-curated recipes that change weekly. They have plans ranging from classic to veggie to family. So if you're, say, a vegetarian, they have options for you there. If you're serving one person, two people, or a bunch of people, they have options for you too. They have varieties of meats, fish, and seasonal produce. All sorts of wonderful vegetarian recipes with plant-based proteins, grains, and seasonal produce there too. It is really, really great. HelloFresh makes it so easy to cook delicious, balanced dinners for less than $10 a meal. No more time-consuming meal planning or grocery shopping, and you can enjoy not having to plan dinner. This is my favorite part. Not having to plan dinner, spending money on takeout for, you know, an easy out, or worrying about gathering ingredients week after week after week. So check it out today. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter offer code ATP30 at checkout. That's HelloFresh.com and code ATP30 for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. Thank you so much to HelloFresh for sponsoring our show.
So for the last few weeks, we've had a reasonably significant amount of people tell us in various states of anger that we need to take Apple to task about how iPhones are throttling CPU performance when the batteries get old, and how this is horse crap, and we really need to beat Apple up because apparently they think that people who matter listen to the show, and guess what? They don't. But anyway,
they do.
Point is, people were really upset about this, and this has been going on for probably about a month now, or nearabouts. And I never found this to be a particularly interesting thing to talk about, a particularly interesting topic, because, I mean, hey, guess what? As your phones get old, they're going to get slow. That I mean, like, I understand that probably shouldn't happen, that a CPU is a CPU is a CPU, but, I mean, hey, as stuff gets older, it gets worse. As I get older, I get worse. And so it stands to reason as other things get older, maybe they will get worse too. But there's been a whole bunch of activity about this, not today, but 7 days ago exactly, wherein we actually got some information from Apple. So I'm going to try to do my chief summarizer in chief, and you guys jump in and or, you know, correct me after the fact. And what it sounds like is, and I experienced this with my 6, or maybe it was my 6S. As my 6 or 6S got older, occasionally it would go from something like 20 or 30% charge, as reported by the iPhone, to dead. It just turned itself off. And this was deeply infuriating, because here it is, I'm trying to perform some sort of task, and my battery says that it's at something like a third charge. I don't use battery percentage, or I didn't use battery percentage before the iPhone 10, because I'm not a monster. And so anyway, I just
look at
a
lot of friends with this segment.
Oh, I know. But regardless, well, I already made friends with my Fahrenheit discussion, so you know what? Why not? Sorry, I'm not sorry. But anyway, the point is that, you know, I look at the little icon and it says it's about a third full. I go to perform some sort of operation. Suddenly the phone turns off. So then I turn it back on. Suddenly it's back at a third battery. And that seems really, really weird. Well, what it sounds like was happening was that when the CPU or other components were really, really asked to do a lot, it would cause enough draw on the battery that the battery would end up kind of just not failing, but just going kaput. And so the phone would turn off and that would be that. And so what Apple's decided to do is, as the battery gets older and as they realize that the battery can't really handle this anymore, they will start throttling the CPU. And so they'll not let the CPU operate at 100% speed in order to prevent these sorts of things from happening, which to my eyes is a perfectly reasonable engineering solution to a problem. And this problem is that batteries, as they get older, they get crummier. That's the way batteries work. It may not be the way CPUs work, but it is the way batteries work. And so to my eyes, like, that's perfectly fine. I don't see why everyone has gotten up in arms about this. But, oh man, a lot of people are really angry about this. And I think part of that is probably because as you upgrade to the latest versions of iOS, and as you have operating systems that are more and more taxing on the CPU, it ends up causing a system-wide slowdown. So not having experienced that, because I've gone on the complete, you know, douchebag, I get a new iPhone every year train, but I was not always on this train. And I do remember times when my older phones got a little bit slow over time. And I think the moral of the story is these devices, or certainly the latest versions of iOS, aren't really designed to use two-plus-year-old phones, maybe 3 or 4 year-old phones. Like, and maybe the thing that we should all be up in arms about is, why is iOS 11 being supported all the way back to the iPhone 4 or whatever? That's probably not accurate, but just for the sake of conversation. And that's, to me, the thing that maybe is a little bit more controversial. But the fact that the CPU is being slowed down, like, hey, this is making it so your phone doesn't spontaneously die. But okay, fine. If you prefer that, go ahead. Maybe that's what we should do. And I think it was either Panzerino or Gruber that said, I think it was Panzerino that said, hey, the issue here is really communication, that Apple never told anyone why this was happening. And if they just disclosed, hey, we've realized that these spikes in battery draw have caused the batteries to temporarily fail probably isn't the right word, but, you know, give up, that's why we've throttled your CPUs, is to prevent that problem. And if they had said that up front, then I think this wouldn't be an issue, but they didn't. And so here we are. So that is not a very succinct summary, but that is the summary nevertheless. And I apologize. But Marco, tell me about this. What do you think?
So it seemed like this is a very well-intentioned solution to a very real problem.
I agree.
But because of the context that is complicated and hard to get rid of, which I'll get to in a second. So because of the context, and because of the execution details of this, I think it's a really big problem for them. So the context is probably the most important part here, that we've known, you know, anybody who is an Apple fan or Apple defender in any way ever, and Apple frequently needs defense because people out there have a lot of horrible misconceptions about Apple, and they have forever, right? And I think this is part of why Apple fans are so defensive so much of the time, because there's so much bad information out there about Apple, and people are always having to like fight it or correct it. And so one of the things that a large portion of the population who buys iPhones believes is that Apple intentionally makes their phones slower with every new software update to make them buy new phones. And there is some truth in this, not in the intentionality of it, but there is some truth that new OSs do usually run slower on old hardware than the ones that they shipped with. I don't think Apple's doing any of that intentionally. I think, as John Gruber wrote today, like, I think, you know, Apple employees would just quit before they would do something as like crazy and fraudulent and evil as that. But the fact is, the new OSs do usually run worse on the old hardware than what shipped with them. And that's just because they're, you know, new OSs. There's new animations and higher memory usage and, you know, more stuff happening in the background, because it seems like these are designed to run really well on the current generation, and making them run on previous generations is it doesn't seem like it's a very high priority to make that smooth or awesome. And maybe, and honestly, I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe there's tons of people working on that. But the results that people see usually is that when they update their like 2-year-old phone to the newest OS that comes out every fall, it's slower and it gets worse battery life. Now, there's lots of complicating factors to this that make this, you know, partially true, partially not true, partially the, you know, inevitable, you know, the behavior of lithium-ion batteries over time, the progress of software over time. But the fact is, there is this very widespread belief that this is planned obsolescence, that Apple is forcing people's phones to be slower over time so that people go out and buy new phones. So that is the context in which this story now comes out. Now, Apple has been doing this for almost a year. They even Panzerino linked to an article he wrote last February, saying, like almost a year ago, saying like Apple said this about this new update, and here's what it does. Because there was a big problem back then about iPhone 6 and 6s, I believe, as you mentioned, doing like the whole like, you know, unexpected shutdown thing when they were getting a little bit old. What has come out over the last few days, as you mentioned, there was a Reddit post that kicked it all off. We'll link to it in the show notes, where somebody basically said that he ran Geekbench, which is a popular benchmark, before getting his battery replaced. And then he got his battery replaced by Apple and ran Geekbench again. And that his CPU performance before the battery replacement was like half of what it was after. So he made this Reddit post saying like, hey, it looks like Apple is throttling CPU performance when your battery is old. And it took a while before, like, everyone was getting all up in arms for a few days. And then about 9 days ago, was it John Poole, the guy's name at Geekbench? I believe it's John Poole. The developer of Geekbench went through all the data and found like trends and peaks of like all the iPhone 6s and 6s and 7s that are running Geekbench before and after the software update that added this behavior, and their different, you know, performances like in the aggregate. And there were very, very clear peaks. Like before the update, there was a clear peak where it's supposed to be. And then after the update, there was still that main peak where it's supposed to be, but then there were like three other peaks at lower levels at about even intervals. Like it's subtracting like 20%, 20%, 20%. There were clear peaks there that like, okay, there's clearly a lot of phones that are benchmarking in these levels here. And that came out about 9 days ago. And then exactly 7 days ago, Apple issued a press statement basically saying, look, here's what we do. This is to combat lithium-ion battery problems over time when they get older and they can't maintain like the highest peak output when the CPU is drawing the most energy. And so we throttle down those peaks only when necessary to you know, keep the phone running, basically, like, to prevent it from shutting down. So they basically just did, and then confirmed that they did, something that slows down your phone when it gets older. And I know they had, like, I'm sure they had the best of intentions. it's clear from their statement. You know, I believe them. I believe this is why they did it. I don't think they're trying to push new phones even harder. I think the iPhones sell themselves. Like, I don't think they need to break your old phone to sell new ones on a regular basis. But I do think this was done very poorly. Even if this is the right thing to do, the right way to do it is to tell the user. And I said on Twitter earlier, like, this should be a setting and you should tell the user. I have since come around. I don't think it needs to necessarily be a setting because, as somebody pointed out, like, if you turn the setting off, your phone just randomly dies all day. Like, that's not great. So maybe it doesn't need to be a setting, but it absolutely needs to be communicated to the user. These phones are people's primary computers. You can't slow down people's primary computers by, like, seemingly like 20 to 50% for a reason that you don't tell them about and that they have no way to know unless they run a benchmark. Like, all they know is my phone is really slow, and maybe it's just because it's old, I guess. Maybe I have to get a new one, and a new phone is, you know, a lot of money, and a battery replacement is not. So for a lot of people, they could just get battery replacement. If they knew that their phone would be way less slow if they just got a battery replacement for $20 to $70, a lot of people would choose that option and save their money, and maybe that'll help them out. You know, like, so and to not tell them, to slow it down for reasons that are not apparent to the user and are never told to the user, no matter what Apple says the reason is, the users don't know that or don't believe them. So this narrative that we have been battling for years, that Apple is intentionally slowing down phones with each OS update to make you buy a new one, and we've been saying, no, 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 they wouldn't do that, they don't do that, they actually just did that. Not to make you buy a new one, but they but like they are now slowing down old phones with a new software update. And even though their justifications are good, that is not how it looks to the people who it's happening to. And now, like, this is not a small thing. We've talked before about how, like, certain, like, tech myths get embedded in people. We've talked about things like how, oh, you should quit all your apps to save your battery. Those things get embedded and are very, very hard to ever remove. Like, Windows people probably still are defragging their hard drives. Like, it's like, this is the kind of thing, like, this doesn't change. Like, you still have people, when their Macs are having weird problems, you still have, like, everyone in the world telling them to, like, reset their PRAM and stuff, and, like, all these weird little, like, voodoo things that usually don't do anything. What Apple has done with this is they have confirmed the fears of a very, very persistent and pervasive and damaging theory or myth that was going on about what Apple does with iPhones and iOS updates. I think this is going to hurt their reputation in this area for a decade. It might even be longer. This is the kind of thing that people do not forget quickly. This is the kind of thing that, while we might know the truth or how things are perceived or what things probably mean or what Apple probably intends, we may know that. But where this is going to linger forever is, like, your crazy uncle at the Thanksgiving table and stuff like that. Like, people who, like, kind of casual users who think they know what they're doing and who spread that knowledge around their friends and family, this is going to persist with them for a decade. And this is going to just be, Apple's going to have to fight this for a decade. And what they really, really should have done instead, which would have, like, anything they would have done here to solve this problem is hard. Like, there's downsides to any solution to the problem of, like, oh, if your battery can't actually run the phone at its full speed and you get random shutdowns, well, yeah, that's bad. They should do something to fix that if they can. And they did. Even with the fix, even if they did it perfectly with great communication, people would say, I am upset that Apple is slowing down my phone until I replace the battery. But at least they would know. It wouldn't seem like deception. It wouldn't seem like there's like this huge ulterior motive that they want you to buy a new phone. They want to trick you into buying a new phone. The only way to make this right is to clearly communicate to the user when this throttling happens, to put up a notification or something. It can't just be buried in the battery screen and settings, like waiting for you to go check it. You have to notify the user with a dialogue or a notification that says something like your battery condition, you know, needs to be serviced or is too worn out or something like that. As a result, your phone will not perform at its fullest, something like that. Like, tell people exactly what is happening when it happens. The first time that it has to be throttled by this mechanism, put up a notification, put up a dialogue that says, your battery is too weak to do this, your phone will now be slower because of this, and, you know, click here to, for more information or whatever. You have to tell people. This problem would have been so much smaller and more manageable and so much better received if they would just tell people when this happened.
So I agree with you that the messaging is the crux of the issue, but do you really think, like, Joe Consumer is going to be aware of this whole kerfuffle? Like, has this reached regular media? Because it seems to me like this is just nerds getting angry about nerdy things. Is it not? Or maybe I'm missing the boat.
Oh, no, no. I mean, first of all, like, my tweet about this has, like, hundreds of retweets already as of 7 days ago. It's like this is spreading far and wide, and regular people don't have to know about this. Their crazy uncles at the Thanksgiving table are the ones that have to know about this, and they're all the ones on Reddit who are picking all this up. Believe me, it spreads. It spreads to all of them. It's all this. It's all those people who advise everyone in their life that they have to quit all their apps. It's the same thing. Like, it's that. It's spreading through that support channel, like the casual, crazy power user support channel of people who are partially but not adequately informed and who spread that to all the people they know. This will be there for a decade.
You two aren't really helping much on this, and neither are the million headlines that have been about this, because I, you know, setting aside all the perception issues, which are totally true, and, like, you know, there's at this point there's not much Apple can do about it, and they should have communicated better and so on and so forth, everything Marco's already covered. For the people who know or are casually listening to this podcast, or it's on in the background or whatever, the essential thing that both of you did that I think is not the right thing to do is to promote the sort of summary narrative, like not the nuanced, detailed, exactly what's going on thing, but the summary narrative is that, as I would describe it, there was a perception that Apple's doing a thing to make their phone slower to make you buy new phones. People in the know said they're not doing that, but now we have new information that shows that actually they kind of were. And that's where I draw the line, because the perception was Apple was doing something, doing whatever, to make you buy a new phone. That's the important part of the story, because it makes Apple the bad guy. Not that Apple is doing something that makes your phone slower, because we all know that Apple is doing something to make your phone slower. It's called releasing new OSs. Like, that's what they're doing. But that's what we would tell them. It's like, they're not doing it on purpose. They just made a new OS, and new OSs very often make your phone slower for all the reasons Marco listed, and we can go into all the details, and they don't even care, right? But they said, no. It's not like they're doing that. They're doing something on purpose that they don't have to do, that's not part of the new OS, to make your phone slower so that you will buy a new phone. Not for any other reason. Not because, you know, they added more features or background processing or blah, blah, blah. For no reason other than you must buy a new phone. And to make the summary narrative, it says, we said they were never doing that, but guess what they were? They weren't. They're not doing a thing to make you buy a new phone. That, I feel, is the important thing. And you're right that people won't catch this nuance. Like, everyone will just assume it's been confirmed. But I think it's irresponsible of people who run tech websites and do tech podcasts to say that in any way what came out today confirms the false narrative from before. It seems like it might if you don't know what you're talking about, and it will make people think it confirms. I totally agree that perception is there. Like, but the truth of the situation is that Apple is not and was not doing something to make you buy a new phone. And that's the only nuance point I want to make to the people who care about nuance points. Not that it's going to help. You could talk about it as carefully as you want. People are going to believe what they want to believe. You know. So I'm totally pessimistic and cynical about the communication thing. But I do want to make that point here that I think no part of this confirms the false narrative, right? It makes people think it does, which is terrible for Apple. And Marco's right. This is going to be really, really bad for them. But it doesn't actually confirm it. And on that issue, with if they had communicated it better, that would be better. But in the same way that I'm pessimistic that even if you understand all the nuances, it doesn't matter. Like, perception is reality to lots of people. By the same token, if Apple had communicated this, guarantee some percentage, perhaps a smaller percentage, but some percentage would say, that message is fake. Apple just puts that up. Why do they put that up? To make you buy a new phone. They're lying to you with this dialog box that says your phone's going to slow to make you buy an... Oh, what a coincidence. New iPhone comes out and I get this dialog box on my old phone. It's telling me I need to buy a new phone. Right? Now, again, doesn't mean they shouldn't do it. It's still the right thing to do. It's still way better than what they did. But this is the job of, you know... And arguably, this is why they made this this decision not to say anything about it. Because they're trying to find the way to minimize the bad perceptions. And I think probably communicating would be the way to minimize it, because the really hurtful part of this is like the error of omission, the deception by omission of like, Apple never said anything about this before, right? And that is a deceptive thing to do. And so that's on Apple, and they deserve some of the reputation hit they were taking there. But yeah, there's no perfect solution. So I, you know, even if they change it to do that, and I heard some good suggestions on Twitter. I forget who suggested. Maybe it was Marco. Maybe it was someone else. Like change the color of the battery meter to like purple, or I don't know. They already use red and green and yellow, but some other color to show like it's not just that your battery is like lower in the middle, but we found out that your battery is underperforming. And to what Casey said at the beginning of this. Your battery doesn't give up. It just is not capable of delivering either the volts or the amps that are required by the CPU. And the CPU has things that cause it, you know, or not the CPU, but like the parts of the electronics say, look, if my voltage or current are both drop below some threshold, game over. Right. And that's what's happening. So the battery is there dutifully pumping out as much energy as it can. And the CPU is like, nope, sorry, it's game over. Can't do it. Everything goes black. Not that it really matters the details, but anyway, that's what's happening. And, you know, the if you want to get on Apple for doing a thing that, you know, what you know, 5Y this down to like, what is the root cause here? You could get to the battery is not easily replaceable, but, you know, it's not that expensive to replace it. You could get to the size of the battery. You could get to how long, if you use your phone like a regular person, how long does your battery last? Like the planned obsolescence thing is, I feel like, different than the perception that Apple is doing, you know, an evil thing to make you buy a new phone. Because planned obsolescence, you could say, they make a sealed phone with a battery that will be crappy after 2 years. And they know all those numbers. They know how long it will last. They know that it's sealed, so on and so forth. Isn't that planned obsolescence? Because this phone is released to you, and they know the plan is that if you use this like a regular phone, it will be a much worse phone in 2 years. And that's essentially their plan. They could make a phone that becomes a much worse phone in a week. They could make a phone that becomes a much worse phone in 5 years. Where have they chosen to draw that line is wherever they draw. I don't know if it's 2 years. I'm just making a number. But that is a design choice. And this brings me to a thing that has been buried in our show notes for a while that I will now hoist up because it is relevant. This is a YouTube video from, God, one of the things I hate most about YouTube is how hard they make it to find the stupid date. From September 1st, 2017. This is another typical sensationally titled thing, like all the articles today about, you know, new information reveals that Apple is just as deceptive as your crazy uncle always said. No, that's not what it confirms at all. Anyway, is Apple ruining your Mac's performance? Question mark. Isn't that great? A clickbaity title.
It's like every Doug DeMuro title ever.
His are yes. His are boring because they're two the same. The number one pinned comment on this is Apple ruining your Mac's performance. Spoiler alert: yes, this article is about thermal throttling on Macs, which actually Marco talked about a little bit, mm-hmm. although he surmised it was thermal based. Like when you plugged in your external monitor at the beach house, like the, how it slowed down the clocks on your MacBook Pro. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, this is a pretty significant limitation of the 2017 MacBook Pro, actually.
Yeah, and this is not just the test was an iMac, right? So this is another case where, again, the sensational headline would make you think that Apple is inserting code. I mean, this isn't about making you buy a new Mac, but Apple's inserting code that says your computer could be faster, but we're going to do something in software to make it not faster and withhold the performance from you because we're evil Apple and we do this for insert reason that doesn't make any sense. Because obviously, as Gruber points out and as many people point out, like people think it's in Apple's interest to make you buy a new phone, but it is not in Apple's interest to make you buy a new phone by sabotaging your current iPhone, because that will just make you feel bad about iPhones and it'll make you want to buy a different phone. But anyway, setting that aside, logic doesn't factor in. Like, again, perception doesn't matter. Logic does not enter into it. The reason so many Macs thermal throttle, and if you watch this video, this is about like gaming performance on an iMac or actually a MacBook as well. Maybe it's both. I forget. Anyway, he puts it in like a freezer, and runs the benchmark and having out of the freezer. So, you know, all these sort of temperature things. Look, I'm not making this up. Look, performance is here. But then as things warm up, performance goes down. You can see this stair step pattern in the graphs of what your frame rate is. And then you put it in the freezer and you don't see that. Like, it's pretty clear that things inside this computer run at more or less full speed until it gets kind of hot and sweaty in there. And the mechanisms inside the computer that are there to protect the silicon from, you know, melting itself say, whoa, 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 let's start slowing things down. And it cranks down the clock speed. And this doesn't have to do with battery life. This has to do with, like, performance. And I would say that, you know, again, Apple is not doing a malicious thing to make your computer bad because they are evil, you know, rubbing their hands together, villains twirling their mustaches. But they did design a computer. They did design a computer in which if you play a game on it in, you know, in a certain reasonable ambient temperature for human kind of room, eventually it gets so hot that the mechanisms that protect the silicon will kick in and it will start throttling down. And Apple designed that computer, right? Now, is it a manufacturing defect? Did they put it together wrong? Is the thermal paste not working? Is the heat pipe not working right? Or are they all like that? Or are they all like that after a certain number of years? And then in the beginning, they're not like that. Whatever the thing is, this is a product that Apple made, and you are not getting all the performance you would hope to get out of it, that you could get out of it if it had better cooling. And same thing with the plugging in the external monitor. Whether that is a sort of programmatic, when the external monitor is plugged in, just throttle down immediately because we know there's going to be thermal issues, or whether it just so happens that as soon as you plug in the external monitors, it immediately trips the thermal thing and it drops it down. Either way, Apple's ability to extract heat away from the heat-sensitive components is inadequate to allow those components to run at their top-rated speed all the time. And that is a design choice by Apple, or a design flaw from Apple, however you want to phrase it. In no case is it malicious, but it is a real fact of the products. And, you know, another reason we're all, I'm waiting for a Mac Pro is, like, you know, it's a compromise that you may say, well, that compromise allows it to be thinner and lighter, especially with a laptop. With an iMac, it's harder to justify. Say, well, yeah, it is thin back there, but does it really need to be? But we want it to be sleek and elegant, whatever. These are real, you know, and same, this is like the phone with, like, oh, they chose to put a battery in there that maybe if it was a bigger battery, you'd have more headroom and you wouldn't have to charge it full as much. And you could, you know, have more buffer on either side of it, sort of use the middle part of the battery like Marcos Tesla does, or they could buy batteries from a different manufacturer, or they could, you know, like, there are things you can do to design the phone to try to avoid this situation. And that, I think, is a legitimate place of potential difference with Apple. And arguably, they have made different moves there, because this is about the sixth generation with the shutdown stuff. The 7 had a bigger, better battery than the 6, right? And the 10 seems to have a bigger, better battery still, right? So it seems like they are making adjustments and learning from where they came from. But that, I feel like, is, you know, the communication stuff and everything, it's, I feel for Apple, but at the same time, by being secretive and crossing their fingers that people wouldn't notice, that's on them, and they you know, they get all the bad PR. I do feel bad that the perception will not match up with reality, even more so now because of this. But I also think that the design choices that Apple has made that cause performance degradation, like, their compromises, I'm not sure they have struck the right balance. It really depends on who you are. Obviously, tech nerds are going to say that, of course, you struck the wrong balance because I'll give up, you know, half a pound to get a non-throttled GPU. Other people might want the half a pound because they don't care about throttling and all they do is use Microsoft Word all day. But from my perspective as a tech nerd, it bothers me to get a product that has to be sort of, you know, babied or used in a freezer to get the sort of the rated performance out of it. Kind of, not to trash on Marcos Tesla, but kind of like the Teslas, where a lot of people wrote in when we talked about Teslas and road tests and how I felt like it wasn't getting its due and how, you know, it's such a great performance car, but it's never put up against the real ones. And a lot of people pointed out, and I should have recalled this from reading all the lightning laps, a lot of that is not just because it's not great at handling because it's really heavy, but also because you drive a Tesla hard around a racetrack, and eventually the Tesla is like, not so much. How about you lay off a little bit? And it goes into not limp mode, but it goes into please stop hurting me mode, because my battery's getting really hot, and I really don't like doing, you know, hot laps, as they're called, like literally hot laps. I'm not up for this. And so it's hard to get a bunch of, you know, good lap times, because you do one or two fast laps, and the Tesla says no more. like, you know, like thermal throttling on a Mac, and like the battery that can't give enough juice, it says, well, can we just wait for the battery to cool down a little bit, maybe? And that's not something you're looking for in a performance car. So fast in a straight line, not so fast around curves, and you drive it fast for a long time, and it really, really doesn't like that, and says with its electronics, you will not be doing that anymore for a while. I'm sorry. Physics. You know, my bad. So anyway, to wrap this up, somehow I've managed to turn this story about Apple software protecting its hardware into a story about how I really want the Mac Pro to not be thermal throttled and Apple should make its computers faster.
I'm shocked. Worse.
Right. But yeah, like I said, if you take one thing away from this, take away the sad realization, the idea, the knowledge that none of this information actually confirms the evil things people used to think about Apple, but everyone will believe it does. And that's a bummer for Apple, and they're partially to blame with bad PR handling. But you should continue not to believe that Apple purposely slows down computers, because A, that would be a dumb thing to do, and B, they don't do it to make you buy a new phone.
Also, please never put your computing devices in the freezer. Condensation exists. This is a problem.
Put them in mineral oil. Come on.
No, like remember, you probably don't know about this because you were always a Mac person. In case you might remember, do you remember back in like one of the early heydays of overclocking in like the very late 90s, early 2000s, overclockers started using, I don't know how these are pronounced, Peltier plates. You know what I'm talking about?
I know about this. No. I think I know about this.
Yeah. So so one of the ways that, you know, water cooling was not extreme enough if you wanted to push like a Celeron up to 2 gigahertz or whatever. So people started using these Peltier devices, which are these like thermoelectric things that they're solid state, no moving parts, and you apply a ton of power to them, and one side gets super cold and one side gets super hot. I think anti-griddles use these, I'm not sure, but anyway, however you pronounce those things, overclockers decided that this was a good way to get even colder cooling of their CPUs. They could push them even further, and it's especially egregious because all the power that it draws, which is a lot to perform this cooling, the hot side gets all the heat of the processor plus that wattage that it's using. So it, like, the cold side gets a little cold, the hot side gets really hot. And
it was the Mac DLT of cooling solution. Hot side hot, cold side cold. I miss the Mac DLT.
Yeah, anyway, and so one of the problems, one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why people, I don't think, really use those for more than about 6 months, is because once you introduce the possibility for something in your computer case to get below ambient temperature, you start having problems with condensation and possibly frost. And this is a really big problem inside of a computer case.
Like, electronics do not like water.
Like, if you, like, and of course they decided, okay, now we can back off frost and condensation, and now we can just go to pumping water through our case. That's much better.
Well, I mean, like you said, it's all about ambient temperature, because if you start making the surrounding air cooler and it can no longer hold the water that is in it, it condenses out of the air, that's a problem. But if everything is at air temperature or higher, it's still way lower than the temperature of the little hot piece of silicon in there. So you're fine with condensation. Yeah. You just got to make sure you have no leaks.
So is that it on the deliberately planned obsolescence that may or may not really be a thing?
It's not. You're doing it again. Not may or may not really be a thing. It's not
I'm
really
kidding.
A thing.
I'm kidding.
Like, see,
good
this is the problem. Like,
job.
No matter how
good
much people
grief.
Talk about it, but they're like, yeah, but this does kind of confirm what everyone said, doesn't it? No. No, it doesn't. Because what they were saying,
John,
what they were saying
I,
was
oh
not
gosh.
That they're slowing down the computer, but for a reason. And this, I know this is a nuance, and I totally agree that no one is going to get this, but the ATP listeners will know. And I would caution you, ATP listeners, do not attempt to explain this to other people, like at Christmas dinner, because it will not go over well. Just nod your head and say, you were right all along. Like, whatever. Don't even confirm that they're right. Just go have a different conversation.
No, guess what? You're not going to be the one bringing it up. Like, all of our listeners who are known probably as like the computer people in their family, all their other relatives are going to ask them about it. You won't have to bring it up. People will ask you.
Yeah, then you can tell them the truth, I suppose. But like, it's a nuance that people don't care about because people really, really want to be right about their conspiracy theory. And then we can get into the psychology of this, of like why, you know, everyone wants to seem like they are savvy, like that the world's not pulling one over on me. Like, this is how they get you. Like, the world attempts to pull one over, but I'm no dummy. I know what the truth is. So Apple, people think Apple's great, but I know the truth about Apple. The truth about Apple is they intentionally make your phone slower to make you buy a new one. And I'm on, you know, they're not fooling me, right? And it's important to them to feel like they are, that the world is not fooling them. This is often people who are mostly being fooled by almost everything in the world. And so they, you know, it's important that they show that that's not the case. So they, no matter how much, like, you will never convince these people that it's not the case. Like, there is no, like, literally you will never convince them. Like, if they could personally speak to and live with for a year every employee living in debt of Apple and be truly convinced that they were never doing this, they would do that in their infinite lifespan, come back and say, yeah, but I kind of think they were really doing it.
Well, like, and it really doesn't help that Apple just basically proved the first 2/3 of their theory correct.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Like, the important, like, there is no two-thirds of the theory. The conclusion, like it's like, this is what they're doing. Like, they're doing it to make you buy a new phone. Because the other part of it is not something to get worked about. Oh, they're doing it to make sure the hardware, to make sure my phone doesn't turn off? Well, that doesn't sound like something I should get that mad about. Because they don't care about the nuances like PR, communication, and so on and so forth, right? Maybe, if you want to convince them, maybe you could say, what you should really be mad about is the fact that Apple didn't say this earlier. And then they can get mad about that, and maybe they'll feel like they still, like, are righteously angry. And they can be righteously angry about that. That's fine. But some people will never give up on the notion of malice. That, like Volkswagen engineers secretly cheating emissions tests. Because that's the worst thing about this. As Gruber points out in his article, he used Uber as an example because he doesn't know about the automotive world. But VW is probably a more apt example. Large corporations do legitimately do actual, actively, maliciously evil, cheaty things like this. You know, not by accident, not to protect the engine, but, like, detect when you're being emission tested and pretend like you have less emissions than you do, but then really when you get used as a car, put out way more emissions. Volkswagen did that, and that's not good for that company. So it's not a stretch to believe that a corporation would do that, but, you know, the reason, I mean, and I guess we have to say, like, the reason we all believe Apple wouldn't do this is mostly because it doesn't make sense. I mean, it's partially because we know people at Apple and we trust Apple and believe it and maybe we're suckers and blah, blah, blah. But also because, unlike cheating on emissions tests, which has a big upside for VW if they can pull it off, successfully pulling off intentionally making your phones worse to make people buy new ones, like, it wouldn't make people buy new ones. As Gruber has pointed out many, many times, it would make people buy an Android phone. Like, if they knew, like, if their phones just get worse. And this has happened, by the way, with the shutdown stuff. I've seen stuff like, I bought my last iPhone, but then it just kept turning off. Forget it. My next one, I'm getting an Android phone. It's way cheaper anyway, right? That's what actually happens if you intentionally, or not intentionally. Like, if the phone you have starts getting worse, it, you know, like Casey with his BMW, if your engine keeps blowing up, you're thinking maybe my next car won't be a BMW. He's not like, that clever BMW tricking me into buying another BMW by making my engine blow up intentionally. That's not... not how the world works. But people do really want to feel like that, you know, they understand how they get you and the world's not pulling one over on them. So,
well, because in this case, the world did pull one over on them. And this one's like the only fix to this. I mean, it's going to be a long-term reputation problem. And this, you know, having malice attributed to it is going to be a very long-term problem. But the only way to start fixing this is to communicate about it from the phone. A PR statement is not enough, because most of these people will not read PR statements, and if they do, they won't believe them. The phone has to tell them when this throttling happens and tell them why it's happening.
How much do you think that will help? I agree that it will help, but how much?
Oh, massively, because that totally changes the view of it, not for everybody. They're not going to convince everybody. But they will. It'll at least appear that they're not trying to hide this fact from you, you know. Because the narrative is that they are secretly, like, trickily, like, slowing down your phone. If they tell you your phone can't run at full speed because the battery is too worn out, that's a very different look. And again, that's going to piss people off too, but not as many. It's way fewer.
Right. Well, let's give a percentage, right? So, like, if 100% is everyone suddenly has good feelings and 0% is this doesn't make anybody feel better, what percentage would you say that this helps?
Maybe half to 2/3, I'd say. I mean, a lot.
We're on the same page, because I think it's half as well. My guess would be about half. Like, half of the people will see that dialogue and will be like, yeah, it's a bummer, but I understand what's going on. And the other half of the people, like I said, will say, this dialogue box proves that Apple's trying to get me a new phone by lying to me with this dialogue box. So it is way better than what they did this time, but I'm pessimistic that this will, you know. And if you think about it, like, I don't know, the not saying anything strategy, pretend the not saying anything strategy had been ongoing, and you know, this whole information had not come out, right? They just continued with the not saying anything thing. Apple could have theoretically weathered that storm and just put better batteries in their phone, and eventually the sixes all cycle out, and then, you know, they sort of quote unquote win. So the, you know, this strategy they chose to do was riskier, right? Because something like what just happened could happen. But the potential upside, I think, is better than the 50% solution, where half the people think now the dialogue box is proof positive that Apple is trying to trick you into buying a new phone by making your phone slower. Because that dialogue box is total BS. My battery's fine. I know it's fine. But it's telling me I need a new phone. It's just, you know, anyway.
Well, and to be clear, they said, like, they said in a statement that right now it applies to iPhone 6 and 6S, but it's going to, but the 7 is going to be added soon, and future devices will be added as time goes on. Like, they said that. So it isn't a problem inherent to the 6 and 6S. Like, this problem isn't going to go away.
Right, but I think the battery is better in the 7, though. Like, I think, like, they put a bigger battery in, and that supposedly will make it, you know, so that it doesn't go undercurrent as, you know, so maybe it'll last instead of 2 years, 2.5 years, or whatever. Like, I think they're, because I think the root problem is sort of the design lifetime of the phone, right? It's not like, you know, they have to pick a design lifetime. Like, you have to, like I said, they could pick any number they wanted as their target, right? I think they've been moving their target up, which will help them with this problem. There is no phone they can think of design where this problem will never come up unless they have totally different battery technology. So they have to pick a time. And no matter what, they need to have this messaging. So if someone happens to keep their phone, if they make a phone the last 5 years, so what if someone keeps it for 6 years? You still need all this mechanism in there for when it goes bad. It's just a question of what that number is. And I think the number is farther out on the 7s and 10s. We'll see. We'll see when they add the software feature. I mean, you'll find out basically if, like, do people have 7s now that are, like, switching off like KC6 used to? Or are all the 7s too young at this point? I don't know. I haven't heard it. I mean, I have a 7, so I'll be watching for it. But it's an inherent problem with the battery technology and the problem with having a sealed battery and all that stuff. And so communication will help with that, but I think Apple also dreads the idea of people seeing that dialogue box, because some percentage of people will see that dialogue box and have a concrete thing to point to say that Apple is malicious and evil. Like, they look at this dialogue box. Apple's coming right out and telling me you should buy a new phone because we're artificially making your phone slow to make you buy a new phone. Like, that's how they'll read that dialogue box, and that's a bummer.
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with Squarespace. No matter what kind of website you're making today, whether it's a new blog or a portfolio or a site for a new business, even a podcast, or even an online store, Squarespace has so much built-in functionality, you can probably do everything you need to do on Squarespace. And look, if you're listening to the show, I know you're probably like me a little bit. At least you're probably a little bit of a nerd, and you probably know how to make your own websites. There's probably other ways you can do this. Trust me, try Squarespace first. Whether it's a site for yourself or if somebody else has asked you to make a website for them, try Squarespace, because you can get really far in an hour or two. You can probably even be finished, or at least be close to finished, in an hour or two. And you can do all that during the free trial. They don't even have to ask you for a credit card. You can just start the free trial at squarespace.com and just see how far you get. And it's going to be so great. I bet you're going to stick with it. It is so easy to use, no matter what your skill level is, beginner to advanced. Your sites look professionally designed. They scale up to any screen size and any device, and they have so much built-in functionality, and you don't have to worry about things like installing security updates or keeping the site up if it's getting a lot of links in. They take care of all that for you. If you need any help, they have amazing support available. And if you're making a site for somebody else and they need help, they ask Squarespace instead of you. Check it out today at squarespace.com. Start a free trial. See what I'm talking about. When you want to sign up for Squarespace, which I'm sure you will, make sure to use the offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with Squarespace.
Apple is taking a page from the Windows playbook.
I wouldn't say that. At least I hope not.
Just today, and by today I mean exactly 7 days ago, I should say that Bloomberg released a post, this is Mark Gurman, saying Apple plans combined iPhone, iPad, and Mac apps to create one user experience. Speaking of a Microsoft tagline, one user experience.
And speaking of a headline that does not accurately represent the ideas contained in the article.
That's true, too.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, no way. So this is, a post by Gurman, and the summary seems to be that there will be a change probably next year, if he's right, that what we currently think of as a universal app, or maybe there'll be a new term for it, but there will be a mechanism by which the same app can be run on iOS and macOS. And so in the same way that we have universal apps on the iOS App Store, which can be run on iPhone and iPad, in the future, and I guess Apple Watch, although that's not really part of being universal, but anyway, but it's three different platforms. In the future, there may or perhaps will be a mechanism by which we will have the same app running on iPhone, on iPad, potentially on Apple Watch, and on macOS. And nobody really knows what the engineering mechanism is behind this, but that supposedly is the future, if you believe Mark Gurman. So I think it's worth pontificating about what the different paths are to this end. But before we go down that road, are there any immediate thoughts on this, starting with John?
I think the important thing, the important part of the story to think about, and this is just a rumor, so we don't know, blah, blah, blah. They did a lot of equivocating in this, of like, oh, but it might come next year, but they might cancel it, but it might not. Great. Okay. So the motivation behind this is something that we've talked about in this show a lot, specifically when Marco's been like making Mac applications and stuff and
poorly.
The struggles he's had with that. Here's what I think, why I believe that projects like this are, you know, conceivably going on inside Apple and may actually ship. Apple has an important asset that they brag about in keynotes all the time, but that I think people tend not to think about that much, which is, you know, when they put up that slide that says we have X number of thousands or millions of developers. They brag about number of apps, but number of apps is a proxy for number of developers because developers are writing those apps. Apple used to have a certain amount of people who were Mac developers, but now they have way, way more people who are iOS developers. There are a lot of iOS developers. That is a tremendous asset for Apple. It's a huge number of people who know how to write applications for iOS and do it to make money. It's a virtuous cycle. Like, it's, you know, the whole marketplace. It's great for Apple makes money when they make money. But really, the important asset is a bunch of people out there know how to write iOS apps. Fewer people out there know how to write Mac apps. Fewer every year because the Mac developers get older and most people who are learning to write apps are learning to write them on iOS. One way Apple could deal with this is say, we're just going to sunset the Mac. Whatever, the Mac was the past, iOS is the future. All these developers know how to develop for iOS. We'll just let all the Mac developers retire and go off into the sunset and we'll can the Mac line and blah, blah, blah. And everything we've seen out of Apple PR has said, no, we're not doing that. The Mac is important, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's important until it's not. But so far, the messaging is pretty clear. Thumbs up on the Mac. In fact, we're rededicating ourselves to the Mac. The Mac is an important product. The Mac and iOS fill different roles. We're never going to force the Mac to be like iOS or force iOS to be like the Mac. All those things that they've said. But they do have the problem of a small number of Mac developers, a small number of Mac apps, and smaller all the time. Like, tons of applications are available on iOS and tvOS, but not on the Mac. In the old days of just the PC world, of course they'd be available on the Mac if they were available on any app platform. Now, many things are available on app platforms, not available on the Mac. And one of the big reasons is you have all these developers who know how to write iOS apps, but they don't know how to write Mac apps. And writing Mac apps is different enough that it is non-trivial to do that. So they're assuming Apple wants to keep the Mac around, which they keep saying they do, one way to solve that problem is to find a way to let the huge number of people who know how to write iOS apps reuse some or all of those skills to target the Mac. And that, I think, is what any project like this would be about. It would be about leveraging that asset to you know, bring up their other platform. And yes, the unification is important too, like trying to unify. But, you know, the reason I said this headline was misleading is because it says to create one user experience. But then you read the article and it's like, the application sometimes will use touch, but then sometimes we'll use a mouse and a pointer. It's like, that's not one user experience. That's two user experiences. And it should be, because a mouse cursor is different than touch, and you can't use, you know, different things work in different, you know. Anyway, this is all about leveraging those skills. And I think Marco already talked about this on one of his podcasts that he's already recorded in the past future. I don't know how time works anymore.
The days of future past.
7 days ago, we discussed that under the radar.
Yeah. But I think you'll hear a lot about iOS developers saying, if I could use my skills to either make a Mac app or to bring the app that I already have on iPhone and iPad to the Mac, maybe that would make sense. At the very least, I would entertain it. Like, I wouldn't rule it out. Like, I'd have to see if it makes sense in terms of economics and so on and so forth. There are some potential upsides and potential downsides. But a lot of time, you know, like, it's when you remove the barrier and say you can use your skills that you have for iOS, and you know how to use UIKit and make table views and do all this stuff, and there's some new stuff you might learn, but you can reuse your code and you can reuse your skills to varying extents, they would be open to that idea, because it is a potential new way to make money. And yes, it's a smaller platform, but in theory, we don't know if this is true, but in theory you might be able to charge even higher prices than you do on the iPad. So that's the lens through which I'm viewing all these rumors and getting at what Casey was talking about. Yeah, but how? But how would they do that? There are many ways that they could do it that would be bad for Mac users and bad for developers. Like, they could blow it. But if I wanted to put up, like, what are the goals of this project? The goals are leverage one of Apple's greatest assets, tons of developers who know how to develop for iOS.
All right, so before we talk how, Marco, any other thoughts?
The devil's in the details. But conceptually, I love this idea. It is not going to be an easy thing to do, you know. If assuming this is really a thing they're working on, that's not easy, because the two platforms are very, very different from each other. And I don't just mean like at an API level. I'm talking about just like an interaction and usefulness level and the needs of a Mac app, versus iOS. Like, in many ways, developing on iOS is way easier, because there's a lot of things that you don't have to worry about that on the Mac you have to accommodate or think about or support, just because people expect different kinds of interactions on the Mac. Like, you know, just simple things like, you know, you have the entire menu system. You also have things like drag and drop and different types of, like, you know, data providing services that you have, all sorts of different, you have windowing, multiple windows, multiple documents being open, the entire document system behind that. You have things like undo, which you don't have really on iOS. All sorts of rich behaviors that have been built over time, many of which quite a long time ago, that people expect all, like, you know, quote, computer apps to be able to do now. Things like scriptability, even, like, there's so much that Mac apps do that iOS developers don't ever have to worry about or don't have to even think about. Making something that can do that rich power of the Mac with iOS-like code or iOS-like UI frameworks, that's not a small job. And there's lots of ways to do that very badly. And so a lot of Mac people are wary of this announcement, or they were 7 days ago at least, where they're worried, like, you know, we don't want, like, the equivalent of an iOS app running in a simulator window. Just, you know, and here we are, like, dragging our mouse over it to simulate touch swipes and everything. Like, nobody wants that. And if that's what this ends up being, that would be a huge failure on a number of levels and a tragedy, honestly. But I have a feeling Apple's better than that. Like, I don't think they would do that. I think if they're going to do this at all, they're going to do a really good job of it. And that's, again, that's not easy. And it wouldn't surprise me if they go down this road for a while, and then they eventually decide, you know what, this actually isn't good enough, we shouldn't do this anymore. Like, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
But I feel like even if they did, and maybe they've done that three times already, they would take another run at it, because I feel like the only two possible options are sunset the Mac or find a way to leverage your fleet. Because eventually, in a not huge number of years.
Would you say on an infinite time
scale? No, non-infinite, on a finite and fairly short time scale.
That one just gets the desk gong.
The number of people who know how to make a good Mac app is not going up. Like, it's just not, right? And the number of people who know how to make a good iOS app is going up, and there's a tremendous number of them. So you have to find a way to either, you know, don't have people develop for the Mac anymore, or repurpose, repoint your big asset of that fleet of developers at the Mac, because that's the only way you're going to get an ongoing supply of good Mac apps, right? And so I think, you know, there, like you said, there are just so many ways to do this wrong, right? And if they tried a bunch of approaches and they suck, I think they would say, okay, but let's try again with a different approach. Eventually, you assume the one they come out with is one of, is an approach that they feel kind of okay with, but, you know, they could blow it and try again. But anyway, for the approaches, I think there's a few obvious ones. A couple of the obvious ones, it's not clear to me whether these are approaches that they've decided suck and they don't want to pursue, but at the very least, these are approaches they have code for, are things like UXKit, which is like what... when a lot of applications started appearing on the Mac and people said they looked and smelled kind of like iOS applications, a lot of them used either actual UXKit or similar approaches where it is like a UIKit sort of facade that just calls AppKit stuff under the covers to let you repurpose code that you originally wrote for iOS devices to make an a quote-unquote Mac application that kind of looks and behaves a little bit like an iOS application. Photos for the Mac is a great example. This, you know, arguably like... Contacts or even something like the new Notes application. A lot of these applications maps. That you look at them, what maps? Yeah. A lot of apps out there, they kind of, I mean, there's a family resemblance, but also like behavior-wise, you can kind of tell that they're not just using straight AppKit because a lot of the stuff that you basically get for free with AppKit doesn't exist in these applications. Like different behaviors, different, you know, behaviors in terms of focus and keyboard shortcuts and stuff like that that are just... different for reasons that don't make sense until you realize that they probably just reused a lot of UIKit code. So a UXKit-like approach is one possible way to do that. And like I said, it's not clear to me whether they did that and decided, actually, that's not great, so we're not taking that approach, or they did that over many years with many applications and decided, actually, this approach works pretty well, and this is what we're going to go with. So that approach would be essentially a new framework that's not AppKit, but not UIKit, but it looks very much like UIKit and lets people reuse... some of their code from UIKit, maybe with small tweaks, but a lot of their skills. Oh, I kind of know how table views work. I know how buttons work. I know how, you know, animations and transitions work, right? And there's tons of new stuff you have to learn, too, with menus and so on and so forth. But that's one approach. A second approach is make a new toolkit. And unfortunately, Apple has really used up a lot of the good names. It's a kit for making apps. Oh, we can't call it AppKit. It's a UI kit. Oh, no, forget about that one. It's an HI tool. No, never mind. Like, they've really used... HI kit is one of the ones I've heard. Like, you can combine kit with... Anyway, come up with a new framework that looks almost exactly like UI kit. Because presumably, UI kit represents the best thinking the company has about how to make a UI. But with changes to fundamental things about it that allow it to handle all the things the Mac does, menus, cursors... you know, scroll bars, blah, 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 and also all the things UIKit does. So that's the kind of the actual sort of grand unified, like there is one framework to write applications for everything. And that would mean that it's not a shim on top of AppKit, that presumably they would implement whatever behaviors they implemented would define going forward what it means to be Mac-like, right? As opposed to now where AppKit defines what it means to be Mac-like, more or less, and AppKit itself is influenced by being smushed together with Carbon and HI toolkit and all that other stuff. That's why that what defines our definition of Mac-like, and that definition changed from classic macOS as well. So it's not like the definition of Mac-like can't change. But yeah, an entirely new framework to do it. And that new framework would also be the same new framework that people use for iOS. So when you wrote your iOS application, you would also use, this is like the one new framework that can do everything. The risks in that are, hey, why are you messing up all of these iOS developers' days? Well, I learned all this UIKit stuff, and now I have to learn this new thing that, yeah, looks like not like UIKit, but why do I want to use that? If it's just like UIKit, but subtly different with a bunch of Mac crap that I don't care about, why would I learn that? So that is more difficult to pull off and risky, but potentially the reward is finally Apple has one way to write applications for all its platforms, and, you know, they have a unified API. But in all of these solutions, and I think the real place where... any of these solutions are going to be really hard to come up with something that ends up being, you know, a win for all involved is, you know, as this headline, you know, incorrectly states, it's not one user experience for everybody. Apple still seems dedicated to the idea that a mouse pointer and cursor and, like, you know, the Mac user interface will continue to be a thing, and applications that work like that are different than applications that work when you're touching them with your finger in fundamental, important ways. And there's really no way to say this one magic application just magically works everywhere. I made a tweet earlier today. It was write thrice, run anywhere, which is a joke on the old Java thing of write once, run anywhere. Write thrice means even if it is a unified toolkit and it's the same thing everywhere, you use Xcode, you use one framework, and you write an application that runs on all these platforms, you still have essentially to, quote unquote, write it thrice, which means you have to write the Mac version and do all the stuff with the menus and the keyboard shortcuts and the drag and drop and everything that the Mac has to do. And, you know, right? You have to write the iPhone version, which is a known quantity. And you have to write the iPad version. It's like, well, why do you have to write the iPad version? That's not another version. Ask somebody with an iOS app if the iPad version comes for free because they use UIKit. It does not come for free. You have to not write it thrice, like three times the application, but just because the screen gets bigger, you have to say, let me rethink how my application works. Right? I have to add new elements to it. I have to potentially add new features. You know, like, it's not enough to just be a phone app that is stretched to be a little bit wider. So there's no way of avoiding having to write a good application for every platform if the platforms continue to be different in both form factor and, in the case of the Mac, you know, interface paradigm. Like, that's very different.
And an environment.
Yeah. And no framework, no UI framework will ever eliminate that work. All it can do is say, the only work you have to do is that work to make a good application that works in the Mac, a good app, but you won't have to relearn how, like, colors work, right? You won't have to relearn how, like, to play audio, like, you know, just that they'll unify the underlying things and have one unified framework and one unified language and IDE and one unified binary, but you still have to design essentially three different applications or three very different forms. And by the way, the watch, which, you know, they could unify that as well and not have WatchKit and have that be a variant of this thing if they want to go whole hog. But there's no avoiding that. It's not one user experience. It's one, I guess, framework, one language, you know, and maybe not even that if they end up going with the shim approach. So I believe they have to do this, but boy, there's a lot of ways it could mess up. And so I wish them luck.
So if they go whole new framework, so they make HI Kit or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, come on, it's Swift. There's nowhere. It would just be called Kit.
Well, it's funny. It's funny you say that, because my question was going to be, do they abandon Objective-C? I don't see why that would be either productive or necessary. But Marco, do you think they would abandon Objective-C in this hypothetical HI Kit?
I mean, if it's scheduled, if it's intended to, you know, be in development now and come out in like a year or two, maybe. But as time goes on a finite time scale, you know, in a few, it, like, the longer it is from now, I think the more likely that would be the approach. But I'm not even going to say it's unlikely even now. I would say that that would be reasonable. Like, I don't think that would be overly aggressive to make Kit require Swift. Like, to just have it be a Swift-only framework.
That's different than saying Objective-C is gone, because, like, even if they went full Swift, you have to keep the Objective-C runtime around for a really, really long time, because it's how Swift calls into all the other code, right? So, you know, so, like, but that's not what we're talking about. We're just saying, like, would you have to write it in Objective-C, right? The one thing I think they probably will do is no 32-bit ever, for whatever the hell this thing is.
No, absolutely. I mean,
the Mac itself, as it exists, is going to lose 32-bit probably next year, right? So That's a gimme. It's possible that, depending on the timelines, if they switch the Mac to ARM, this could be ARM only, depending on, you know, is this 1 year, 5 year, whatever, you know, that timeline could coincide to simplify matters. These are all low-level things that really, in the end, don't matter. Like, I think we're into it because, you know, either software developers are into software development things and we're interested in the nitty-gritty details. But the bottom line, like, the most interesting thing from the consumer's perspective is Apple's plan to continue to sell devices of different sizes and different forms, continuing to sell, you know, things that we call Macs, things that we call iPhones, things that we call iPads, things that we call watches, all of which have different ways to interact with them. Some are closer to each other than other. iPads are very similar to an iPhone, but a watch is very different from both of them. And the Mac is very different from the iOS devices, but there's a range of hardware devices they sell. And presumably will continue to sell, because they're not giving up on that range. Like, they're not, you know, they can make new hybrids. Like, Jason and I talked on Upgrade about an iOS laptop. Like, there's other form factors that can be explored. And the other one is obviously touch coming to the Mac and how that might influence things. But in case you mentioned Microsoft at the beginning of this topic, I think that's an important lesson, because Microsoft, for all its success or failure in actually pulling this off, was way ahead on the thinking of, we're going to try to make one software platform that lets you write applications for all sorts of different weird form factors. And so they have laptops that are convertible into tablets that have touchscreens on them, or they also have tablets, and at one time they had phones, and they tried to run the whole range with a single unified platform that you'd have to write, you know, different style applications for. I forget what was their thing. It was like WMP or something like that. They had an acronym for
UMP, I believe.
Yeah, Unified Windows Platform or something.
Something like that.
Yeah, that approach. If Apple could snap its fingers and have something like that now, they would love to have it, because the hard work is coming up with a single framework that could span all those things. But as far as consumers concerned, the interesting part is, so can I buy a thing from Apple where it like runs Mac, you know, it runs Adobe Photoshop, like the legacy version, but also I can get all the new apps, but also I can touch a screen, but also it looks like a laptop? Like, the unified Apple platform is a time to make different decisions about the boundaries between these things. Like, you could get rid of the Mac, iOS, whatever distinction and try to have these universal apps. And we're setting aside economics for now. That's a whole other can of worms. But, like, I think it is an opportunity to revisit how those boundaries are drawn. Because if you're making a new framework, or, you know, a new shim-type framework or whatever it is that you're doing, that's an opportunity to consider, how could the Mac be different in ways that allow you to make touch a useful interface for Macs? And if you've used a Windows convertible or laptop with a touchscreen or whatever, you have some experience with this. And Microsoft is way ahead in both figuring out what makes sense for touching the screens of PCs, for lack of a better term, and also making the frameworks that allow you to do it. Apple's lucky that they just haven't been particularly successful in the market with their approach, but like, that you learn by doing, and Microsoft has done many different attempts at this, and from all accounts, each time they try their new Surface whatever thing and the new operating system that runs on it, makes an ever more compelling case for being open to different form factors and different kinds of input, instead of the sort of rather rigid boundary, certainly between the Mac and iOS, but arguably also between, like, you know, the iOS devices of different sizes. So I'm most excited from a consumer perspective of seeing Apple, like, that's what I want out of a unified thing. It's not like, yeah, the unified technical underpinnings would be awesome, but like, that finally it gives the Apple the freedom to spread it, to make new variations along the spectrum, instead of being siloed into, this is what a Mac's like, and this is what a phone is like, and they're so different from each other, and there's no crossover, and don't try to do it. No iOS laptops, no touchscreen Macs, never, never, never. If it's a unified platform, there's no reason for that distinction anymore, and now they can start exploring different steps along the spectrum.
Yeah, I actually look forward to that, because I do think it's pretty clear, like, the industry and consumers have spoken on the issue of, like, touch laptops. And as much as Apple says, this isn't a good experience, nobody wants this, it turns out a lot of people want it, and they do it anyway, and they try it, and they touch their screens, and nothing happens, and they get, like, this is, like, Apple is losing that fight in actuality, whether they know it yet or not, and I think they probably do know it at this point. You know, they tried, like, one last-ditch effort with Touch Bar and giant trackpads, but that's not enough. Like, that's not what people actually want. What people actually want is to have to touch the screen sometime, or to be able to touch the screen sometimes. Like, that's what people are actually doing and wanting and expecting. So anything that gets us closer to that, I think, is a good direction for the Mac to take, because, again, the reality is, like, this is what people are doing. And a lot of this, I think, the whole idea of this, of, like, this cross-platform UI framework needing to exist, I think, you know, you've put it well, John, that, like, regardless of what you think people should do here, you know, a lot of Mac developers say, you know, people should just write Mac apps in AppKit, and yeah, that they should, but they're not. The reality is very different. The reality is that all the action is happening on iOS in the Apple world. They can't get people to care enough about the Mac to develop a lot of Mac apps anymore. The Mac feels increasingly like a very stale, low priority platform for a lot of developers, including Apple. they have to do something to make it easier for people to bring Mac apps over. And if they don't, we're going to have the situation we have now on the Mac that's going to slowly worsen, which is right now we already have like tons of major applications that are either that are not available on the Mac that have really neglected low priority Mac versions, like the Twitter app, you know. And then we have a lot of apps that say, "Oh, just use the web app." And I'm guilty of this myself, obviously.
Netflix is a great example because you can't even watch 4K Netflix on a Mac because there's no 4K support, probably for some dumb copyright reason.
Right, exactly. And like there's so many types of apps where the answer on the Mac is either, sorry, we don't support it, or just use our web app. Best case scenario for a lot of complex things like Slack, you get these like weird web native apps that nobody likes because they're terrible in a lot of ways and perform badly and use all your RAM and aren't Mac-like and everything else. So like anything, like that's the status quo. That's the reality. Like the reality is AppKit is the past. And as capable as it is to the people who know it, the market has said otherwise. Economics have said otherwise, and people's attention has said otherwise. In many ways, it's similar to Swift versus Objective-C, in that Objective-C, like for people like me who know it really well, Swift came along and we're like, I don't need that. That like I want to just keep using the thing I already know how to use. It's totally fine. But the reality was, one of the reasons they did need Swift, which we talked about at the time it came out, is that Objective-C was old and crufty, and it turned off new developers. Developers were actively avoiding writing Objective-C because it was old and crufty, and it didn't fit modern aesthetics for programming languages. AppKit has that problem as an entire API. Like AppKit is really old and crufty, and when an iOS developer sees AppKit for the first time, it is not a positive impression at all. And any as an iOS developer working through this, and I know other people who've done the same thing, it's like it's really it doesn't ever let up. Like there are certain parts of it that like when you first discover like what NSDocument does automatically for you, you're like, wow, this is really capable, this is awesome. But there's just so much friction in getting those interfaces developed. And to be clear, like the lower level frameworks, like all the audio stuff, a lot of the, you know, data types and stuff, a lot of those things are already unified. Like a lot of the networking, like there's so much stuff that is already unified between the two platforms. The main area where this is necessary is the UI layer. And there are just so many differences. It's not like so many things work completely differently between macOS and iOS. It's a huge barrier to developing for the Mac. It is so hostile and unfriendly, and you can't look up help on the web because there's almost no results for it. And it's like a ghost town of old cruft and unfriendliness. And I know that's not like, if you're familiar with it, if you're an expert in AppKit, you don't see it that way. But for all the rest of the iOS developers who are not familiar with it, that is how it is. So even though it is fine for its current developers, it needs to change because the entire world has changed around it. So something has to happen here. And the Mac, if they gave the Mac its own completely new UI framework that was not shared with anything, look at what happened with tvOS. tvOS had that. It had a whole new framework that was mostly not UIKit. It kind of has its own stuff, although it has way more in common with UIKit than AppKit does. And making a tvOS app is really uncompelling because you have to rewrite your entire UI from scratch, and it's just not very good. WatchOS has a similar problem. Like WatchKit is very little like UIKit, and although it's still way more like it than AppKit, and making a WatchKit app is really not compelling because these are like smaller usage platforms. The iPad is a great example, and I think probably honestly a big part of why this kind of thing might be done. On the iPad, you know, John, you said earlier, like, you know, you don't get an iPad app for free, but you do get it for cheap. like if you have an iPhone app, to port it to the iPad is effort, but it's not a ton of effort. It's nowhere near the amount of effort.
Yeah, because it uses the same UI framework, but then, like, to make a good iPad app, you have to redesign some part of it.
Yeah, but it's, like, you know, like Overcast iPad app is used by something like 5% or less of people. I use it every day, but most people don't use it. But it was, you know, it's about 5% extra work to do it also. So, like, it was worth it to me. And yeah, it could be better than it is. It could be more iPad optimized, but it doesn't need to be. Like, right now, it's fine on the iPad. There's no glaring shortcomings with it. It's totally fine. And it didn't need to be that much work, and it isn't that much of a maintenance headache ongoing. If the Mac can be anywhere near that, I don't expect the Mac to be as easy to port.
It's going
to
be harder because you got menus and all of that, and no touch interface, right?
Right. So it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be as easy as porting from to the iPad from iPhone. But if it can be somewhere near that, if it can be like only 3 times harder instead of 20 times harder, like that's a huge, huge gain. That could lead to so many more Mac apps. And honestly, and you know, as you said, John, honestly, I think I'm not sure the Mac has much of a choice because the reality is that if they don't do something like this, it's just going to keep stagnating and it will die. That is it. Like that is the future of the Mac. It has no future if they don't find a way to make it easier to develop apps for the Mac if you already have an iOS code base.
Well, the other way to have a future is to sell 100 times more Macs, but that's a tall order.
Yeah.
Like if you could suddenly sell as many Macs as you sell iPhones, this problem takes care of itself and people just continue to write an app kit and you're fine. But that's not the reality.
Right, exactly.
So one more technical thing on this. This is not likely, but I like thinking about ways you could possibly get this win. Another problem Apple has with its platforms, arguably, and you know we can debate what the causes are, but there's a lot of applications, a lot of very sophisticated, very powerful applications are only available on the Mac. And Apple would love for those applications to be available on iOS devices, but for a variety of reasons, that's not always the case. Now, if you make a unified UI framework, depending on how you do it, we talked about a shim layer that lets you basically write with a UI kit like API, but that calls AppKit stuff under the covers as a quicker way to let people reuse some of their code and skills to write Mac applications. You could make something like that in the reverse direction to let someone take a complicated, sophisticated Mac application and allow it to run on iOS with some changes to make it work for touch. I'm sure Apple, I mean, I don't know if Apple is frustrated by this, but I know a lot of users are frustrated by the fact that there's no Photoshop for the iPad, right? Adobe makes a Photoshop for the iPad, but it's not Photoshop. It's like Adobe makes a bunch of applications that try to play to the strengths of the iOS platform, but none of them are full-fledged Photoshop. Like there are other companies trying to pick up that slack to say, fine, Adobe, you're not going
to
do it.
Trust me, you don't want Adobe to port Photoshop to the iPad.
I know. I'm just saying, like capability-wise, like Affinity makes a bunch of great applications, and what's the other one? The other well-known one.
There's Pixelmator Pro, Affinity, Acorn, a whole lot of good ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of applications that are targeting it, but there's still a lot of sophisticated applications that are only on the Mac. And you say, well, it's because the Mac is powerful enough and so on and so forth. Like all the excuses for why those are only on Mac eventually will come down to, well, it's written in this framework that doesn't run on iOS, and we're not going to rewrite our whole application because it's really big and complicated. I mean, the only companies that can afford to do stuff like that are Microsoft, and even their iOS versions are, you know, Microsoft Word and Excel kind of in name only. Like they're very different. If you could have a way to make a unified framework in shim layer or something or other that lets a bunch of Mac developers with some amount of work that is less than rewriting their entire application, which is, you know, it's pretty easy to hit that bar. Some smaller amount of work than rewrite everything in UIKit, let them sell their well-known, well-established, extremely powerful application for the new 27-inch iPad Pro. That is a compelling case, and it solves Mac developers' problems in that, well, now suddenly you can address this market with your skills that you have, right? But that's not why Apple cares about that, because they'll just let those Mac developers retire and die, whatever, who cares? It solves the problem Apple has, which is, hey, we would really like it if we could get way more expensive, powerful applications on iOS. Apple's been trying that for a long time. That's why the iPad Pro exists. And it is happening, and it's happening slowly. But one way to get a nice boost of complicated, powerful applications is if you could somehow make that happen. Now, I think that is not a big enough upside for people to undertake this. It kind of goes against what we're trying to get people to do, is to get people to stop writing an app kit. And who cares about the 10 Mac developers compared to the, you know, 1,000x number of them that are on the other platform? So I don't think this will happen. But for the briefest moment, I had the idea of, like, all our greatest and favorite Mac applications suddenly having cool iOS versions and making iOS a more powerful platform and giving new life to Mac developers. But I think that is extremely unlikely, but it gives me a warm fuzzy to think about it.
So one final question, because I can't help myself. Let's assume for the sake of discussion that there's a fairly complete break. And it's not just a shim, it's a completely new HI kit. Do you think that Apple would follow the same like delegation everywhere pattern that UIKit has today? And I'm trying to think of a way to summarize delegation easily, and I can't think of a great one, but...
You want it to all be reactive?
Well, that's exactly what I'm driving at, and maybe reactive.
AppKit has delegates all over the place, too. Is that what you're comparing it to? Delegation, AppKit style, I would say, delegation, as compared to React style stuff?
Well, like functional reactive programming, or something. It doesn't have to be FRP, it doesn't have to be RX Swift, necessarily, but like anything that's more modern than delegation, even just closures everywhere, which I admittedly Apple is moving toward, but like something more modern than delegation. Do you think that it would be a slight step forward, such as closures everywhere? Or do you think it would be a whole hog, like, we're going to just burn the world down and build it anew? Let's go all in on something along the lines of functional reactive programming. And maybe that's not the actual answer, but something that dramatic. Do you think that it would be something that big, if this hypothetical HI kit? Or do you think it would be something much closer to a shim? And let me start with Marco on this.
It's going to be all Cocoa bindings.
Oh, God.
No, I mean, I don't honestly, like, I'm not hugely into the whole reactive thing. I kind of do my own thing with that, but of course. But
Of course.
So I'm not entirely convinced that that is the inevitable forward,
sure,
you know, but, place to go. I mean, but
whatever the answer
So if just the larger question of, like, would they fundamentally change, like, design patterns of the way they do UI frameworks.
Exactly.
It depends on, like, do they want to also, like, blow up iOS as well? Because if the idea of this is to make developing for the Mac more like iOS, then no, they shouldn't move on in such a major way, because that isn't how iOS works. But if the goal of this is to be, like, the next generation unified UI framework for all of their platforms, possibly making it Swift only, then sure, that would make sense. Like, it would make the most sense to design it in a way that takes maximum advantage and fits in best with the design of the Swift language, which would come with lots of changes that don't work the same way. Because, like, so much of AppKit and UIKit is based on the way Objective-C works, and is designed because, you know, they were. It was always the language. It was designed with that in mind, and it was designed with a lot of Objective-C idioms and things that work very well with Objective-C. With Swift, there's a lot of weird friction when you try to, you know, when you use UIKit and a lot of Apple frameworks from Swift, you can tell, like, this really wasn't designed for this, and it's not as good as it could be, or doesn't quite fit in right, doesn't feel right, or is not as graceful as it could be. So. If they're going to move forward and make this, like, the new Swift-only thing that is our modern, you know, answer, like, this is going to be for the next 15 years framework, then, yeah, change a lot to make it more Swift-like. Not necessarily, like, functional reactive. I don't, you know.
Sure, sure.
But just make it more Swift-like, you know, make it ideal for Swift. But if they're going for, let's make it as easy as possible for existing iOS developers to also make Mac apps, then not necessarily.
So you have to, I think, look at, when you talk about UIKit, and even AppKit for that matter, any framework like that that lives for a long time evolves. And you can see, like, as you look down through the layers of, like, how things have changed. Like, as Casey pointed out before, you know, closures were a thing, everything was, you know, straight up delegation. And then suddenly when closures were a thing, even setting aside Swift, it was like, oh, now a bunch of new APIs are coming, take a callback. Right. And they take a closure as an argument. And that becomes a pattern that you start to see. You don't see it everywhere. The old APIs don't have it, but they introduce new APIs that do have it. And so, you know, each new year at WWDC, the framework that you knew slowly changes and evolves. Whatever the next framework is, the most conservative answer is take whatever the current best thinking about UIKit is. Not like make it like UIKit exactly, because there are parts of UIKit that haven't been updated to, use the current best thinking, and, you know, Clojure is an example of like, and that happens to fit with Swift because if it's native support for that, and you don't have to use the stupid block syntax and all that other stuff. But make all of the new APIs use the current best thinking. And I don't think that actually entirely precludes a larger change, because if you keep doing that, like over time, we introduce new APIs with new thinking and there's a new language in the mix and it evolves and evolves and evolves, eventually you get to deprecate or just never use the really old, really weird APIs. So if your starting point is the current best modern thinking UI kit with maybe some minor tweaks, you get a lot of the benefit of people being who are familiar with the UI kit being able to use that, because people who are familiar with UI kit presumably are somewhat up to date on it and don't say, I only know how to use the UI kit APIs introduced in like iOS 2, and I never learned anything after, and I don't know what a Clojure is, and I'm really confused, right? I don't know anything about all these property syntax and all this animation stuff. It's all tint colors. I don't know what that is. Of course they have to know. They have to know the modern ones too. So if that's your starting point, you can bring those people along. Now, with the whole reactive thing, it's like, that's not something you can gradually add. That's kind of a paradigm shift, and that is a tougher sell. But even that, you could pitch that to, you know, pretend the Mac doesn't exist and it's just UIKit. Eventually, in the lifetime of UIKit, if the thinking inside Apple is that there's a better way to design UIs with, you know, whatever reactive paradigm or whatever, some functional thing or something entirely different, they could roll that out just in UIKit to say, a bunch of new APIs are going to be using this thing, and we have a new view system, and we're, you know, Mac has had multiple view systems, even on Mac OS X. It has multiple, you know, it had Carbon and it had Cocoa, and they coexisted for a while, and one of them faded away. It's not impossible to have two paradigms on the same platform and slowly transition to another one. So I don't think anything Apple does precludes switching to something better. But I think the main reason that they won't is, or two reasons. One, I don't think Apple is convinced that there is a better paradigm. Casey may be convinced, but convinced that, like, there is a better paradigm that is better enough to take the hit for it. And B, like, they can defer that. They can say, use the current best thinking in UI kit plus whatever the current best thinking that we don't know about is that they're doing inside Apple, right? Because there's always something every year, right? And make that the starting point of your new framework. And then go from there. We're going to wrap this up because we're running long. But one final thing that I think is worth voicing, especially from the concerns of Mac users. I mentioned Photos apps and how they feel kind of weird. That's another way that this can all go wrong. If they, no matter what solution they use, if it lets experienced iOS developers target the Mac, but the applications they create are all like Photos, essentially, like that they feel weird and non-Mac-like and are unsatisfying, I don't think that will be a very big success, because as few Mac users as there may be, and even Mac users who have no idea what it means to be quote unquote Mac-like, you know, people who have no idea what Electron is or no idea what makes Slack weird, they feel the friction and the weirdness, even if they can't identify it. Even with something like Chrome versus Safari, I think that's a real thing that people can feel. And I think the Mac enthusiasts are actually an important subset of the Mac market at a proportion of the money that they give or whatever, right? It's the whole reason the Mac Pro exists or will exist eventually. And I think that is it's going to be one of the hardest things to avoid. Yes, let people retarget their skills to the Mac, but how are you going to get them to make applications that are satisfying Mac applications? That's a really tall order, both because iOS users don't know how to make a satisfying Mac application because they never have before, and because a lot of things you can do to make it easier for them lead them down the path to an application that is like an iOS application that you can use a mouse cursor with. And that's no good. That's no good, boss.
Well, but I mean, I would argue it's better than not having these apps.
Is it, though? Like, that's what I'm saying. I don't know if it's better than not having the apps. Like, is it better than just letting the Mac platform die? I would rather have a good native 27-inch iPad Pro application than a bad iOS port to a 27-inch iMac. You know what I mean? Like, just...
Sure. Well, but, I keep in mind, like, whatever Mac apps are in practice is what ends up being, you know, the good Mac apps. Like, it ends up being the standard. Like, I really don't think we have a choice here. I think something like this has to happen to keep the Mac alive. And so if what ends up being most Mac apps people use if those are more iOS-y, that will just become what it feels like to be a real to be a standard Mac app.
And that's not I said that I was getting at that before what it means to be Mac-like, but I'm just talking about like just straight up performance, like that they feel laggy and slow and not powerful, like that they don't have the features. One part is a feature set, and the second is that they're slow and weird. And is it because they're slow and weird because of the shim layer? And are they missing features that we expect from a Mac app because they're an iOS port and those features don't fit or don't make sense on iOS? That's what I'm talking about. Like,
and you're totally right to be super concerned about that by using Photos app as the example of a cross-platform framework. But the reason why Photos app on the Mac is slow and weird and doesn't feel right and it lacks so many features and drives you nuts is because it is a terribly designed app on so many levels and horribly neglected all the time. So it starts out with a bad design. They never change it. They never make it better. In your explanation during our famous episode number 223, Throw the Fork Away, was so great, so perfect. The Photos app is a terrible example of how to do cross-platform frameworks. It happens to be built on a cross-platform framework, but it is a terrible design, and that has nothing to do with the framework. It has everything to do with the actual UI design, the flow of the app, the things
don't you think it has to do with the framework and that it like no. the flow in the UI design is inherited in large part from how Photos works in iOS, and then they just added a couple of little sidebars here and there? Like it feels like an iOS application in design wise.
No, definitely not. It is entirely because that is a very badly designed app. It's designed by people who don't use it the way anybody else uses it, if at all. And it is designed to look good in demos, not to actually be used by human beings. That is not a problem with the framework. That's a problem with the design of it. It is slow and cumbersome, not because it copies iOS stuff, but because it has too many modes and too many slow animations, and it lacks convenient keyboard shortcuts. And like,
but I'm getting it. Like, it has those modes because Photos on iOS has to have the modes because you don't have the room on the screen for all that stuff. So like, think about when you go to crop on Photos, you got to hit the little crop icon, and then or you go to like color or light, then you got all the submenus, and you eventually dig your way down to the feature you want. And it's a lot of taps. And why is it a lot of taps? Because you're on a phone, you don't have room to have that stuff visible all the time. But you take that UI paradigm and you bring it to the Mac, and it's still a lot of taps. And you're like, why are you making this a lot of taps? Like, well, this is sort of how the code base works, and we kind of added a sidebar here and there, but we didn't want to change too much. Like, isn't that the whole thing? We don't have to change too much, and we get a Mac application out of it, and it's like, you should have changed more.
That isn't the whole thing. Like, first of all, the fact that they use something called, like, UX collection view doesn't make the design bad. The fact that their views are using UX color instead of NS color and UI color, that doesn't, like, that's what we're asking for here, is like, give us like stock widgets and stuff that we can use in both places, but the actual interface layout and the choices they made with all these different modes and everything, that's just a bad design for the Mac, period. And that has nothing to do with the framework. That is entirely to do with laziness and bad design.
But no, it doesn't have to do with the framework. It has to do with the fact that the code base came from an iOS app. You started with an iOS app, and you're like, I would like this app on the Mac. So you start with that code base, and that code base works the way it works on the phone. And so you don't want it completely, like, you're motivated not to change too much about it, right? So it's kind of, yeah, it's not the framework. It's not the fact that if you had written it from scratch with the same framework as a Mac app, you would be fine. But my fear, what I'm getting at here, is that people have iOS applications that they want to essentially port to the Mac. And they're not starting from scratch and figuring out how to make a good Mac app. They're starting from their iOS app and mutating it until they feel like, yeah, it's more or less a Mac app. And so the Photos app feels like the iOS Photos app mutated just enough to masquerade as a Mac application. And you're totally right, that's not the fault of the framework. It's not the fault of even UXKit or anything like that. It is the fault of the fact that it is essentially a port, and that you start with one code base and you change it, and you know, you don't start over from scratch, right? We're going way too long here, but one of the things that Craig Hockenberry was pointing out about like Twitterific, where Icon Factory wrote their own framework to basically be UIKit on the Mac, what was it called, Chameleon or something?
Yep.
Right. So they have experience doing that. Hey, let's write a framework on the Mac, but the APIs all look like UIKit. They did that, and they also did, let's make a Mac version of an iOS application, and we'll do it by cleanly and slightly painfully, because, you know, programmers aren't perfect, separating the internals from the externals, which all programmers are supposed to be doing, but until you actually try to separate them with a big scissor, you realize how much your crap has leaked into each other, like, that's life, right? And according to Craig, the second approach for them, anyway, worked better for Twitterific, where what they reused across the iOS and the Mac app is all the faceless stuff. But the UI for the Mac app is written totally from scratch. The only part that's shared is the inside. Now, they wrote it from, I don't even know what they used. They could have written it from scratch using, you know, the Chameleon thing. They could have written it from scratch using AppKit. They could have written it from scratch using the hypothetical HI kit. But the point is, they wrote it from scratch. They didn't take the interface from the phone, port it, and start tweaking it. But that I think will be a temptation. It's, you know, sort of the equivalent of shovelware. That will be a temptation if Apple does a good job making that easy. And in fact, Apple will demo that. Look, I went from your iPhone application, and then I just moved a few things around and added a sidebar and set up a few menu items. Voila, Mac app. And I'm going to say, no, not a Mac app.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Casper, Squarespace, and HelloFresh. We will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
Good thing so much stuff happened in the
7 days ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Marco, you said you had watched the first two episodes of the Grand Tour.
I have, yeah. You know what? It's pretty good.
I feel like the in-studio segments are slightly less garbagey than they were last season.
Oh, yeah. To clarify, I skipped those.
But still pretty bad.
Not like, I don't skip like the little bumpers to their segment, but like when they like sit down with a celebrity or something, I skip that. But I always did that with the BBC show also.
Yeah. The BBC show, the in-studio segments were pretty decent, if not good. But man, the Grand Tour in the studio is bad. Outside of the studio, I think the films where they're actually out in the world doing things, I think those are 80 to 90% of what they were for Top Gear. And I'm trying very hard not to spoil anything directly for John. But my goodness, the studio stuff is just nothing. I feel like all I'm doing is cringing the entire time they're in the studio.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. Like, the studio stuff is still, it is as cringeworthy as it was in season one. But season two, episodes one and two, if you skip the studio long parts and you just pay attention to the rest of the, you know, film segments, I'd say it's very good, very fun. And, you know, the last few seasons of Top Gear that they were on, you know, there was like a bit of a decline in those too. And I would say the current season of whatever this is, Grand Tour, is on par with or better than the last few seasons of Top Gear they did.
I think that's fair.
You know, one of the in-studio segments that I actually kind of liked, and I think is the strength that they should be leaning on in Grand Tour, but in season one, apparently they did not. I always like the news segments because it's the most like a podcast.
Yeah.
Like they would have a little TV screen up there to show an image, and they'd be like, just quick hits on the news. Oh, you know, Volkswagen's coming out with a new car. What do you think of this? And they all just have something snarky to say about it in much the same way we do on a podcast. What do you think of the news that they talk about, right? And there's no celebrity involved, and you can't say they're not trying to be funny, because they are. They're trying to be funny, and very often the snarky lines were written ahead of time, clearly, right? Like, it wasn't all spontaneous or whatever, but that lets them be them in a way, in the same way that they would out of the studio, just sort of joking around with each other about a topic that they all have strong feelings about. You think all Porsche 911s look the same. You are into trucks. You are, like, whatever. Like, their personalities and their enthusiasm for cars, which, you know, is my always big thing with Top Gear, comes through in those segments. And they're studio segments, and they're fine. And even some of the celebrity ones, depending on the celebrity, passable. But anything where it's like, we're not going to talk about car news, we're not going to talk about cars, we're not going to talk to a celebrity, we're going to do like a funny skit with each other, did not work in the Grand Tour. Like, just like, because like, what's left then? Then it's just like a bunch of people who are like, are they trying to be Saturday Night Live? Very often they'd be trying to make a joke. They'd be like, huh, isn't that funny? And they'd be like making fun of, like, you know, children with cancer. And it'd be like, no, it's not funny. It's like, but it was funny when I was a boy in 1942. It's like, just guys, like, you can't talk to somebody before you do these segments. Like, it's not, or whatever the one where they were making fun of gay people or hurting ice cream or something. It's like, just talk to one person before you plan a 15-minute segment that you think is going to be hilarious, because
yep,
it's not, and it's no good. And anyway,
yeah, there's a lot more of that. It's definitely like older dudes who think that some of this stuff is funny, and it's just not funny anymore. And the other thing, on the second episode, they officially, maybe they talked about it in the first, but in the second episode was the first time they really did a hot lap, if I recall correctly. And they have ditched the American, and they said something like, yeah, well, you know, it didn't really work out and nobody liked it. And so there was at least a modicum of like self-awareness there. But they bring on a woman, some woman, and they say she's a really great driver. And the reason I haven't named this woman is because they didn't name her. Like, did you watch this, Marco? Did you notice that as well?
Yeah, she was like the new Stig, kind of. But
right,
that was, I assume that was part of some kind of bit that's going to play out over time. But I thought that was weird, too.
Yeah, it just seemed like, I don't know if inappropriate is the right word, but just not funny. It seemed like, you know, 50 plus year old guys trying to be funny in a way that in the year almost 2018 really isn't funny anymore. And I don't think this is me being like a stick in the mud. I don't think this is me being a social justice warrior. It's just, I'm trying to be better about being aware of these sorts of things. And so now that I am more aware of these sorts of things, when they don't name this woman driver, like, they praised her, but they don't name her, it's just like, come on, guys, really? This is really a thing? And just like you said, John, like, nobody told you this was not cool? Nobody? Not a one. Not a single person said that this was not cool. And so I've never fast-forwarded on an initial viewing. I've never fast-forwarded any of Top Gear or the Grand Tour, but...
Oh, you're missing out.
I am... Well, that's the thing. I was about to say, I am paying less and less and less attention to the in-studio segments. That being said, the films I thought were really good, particularly this last one. And again, I'm trying not to spoil it, but it involves Marco and John's either current or old stomping grounds. That one I thought was really good and enjoyable. So the films are great, but golly, the studio stuff, I'm running out of patience for it.
Yeah, there is no question in my mind that if the show was just the films and each episode was like, you know, I guess it'd be like 20 minutes long or 25 minutes long instead of like an hour, if it was just that, it would be a better show.
I mean, I'm looking forward to the rest of the episodes from this season, but I might do the unthinkable and pull a Marco and just skip the in-studio segments, because, oh boy.
I give you permission. It is a much more enjoyable show if you do that.
All right, so we got to look at some titles here.
We got some good ones this week.
As I get older, I guess worse.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I like Hotbox with Knobs.
Hotbox with Knobs is good.
Do those little boxes, does the USB Pre-2 get hot?
No.
Let me see. No.
Nope, not at all. Not even the slightest.
My description is not... I've never had one of those boxes. I just assume they got hot, but...
No.
Hotbox. You guys don't know that movie, do you?
Nope.
Casey should watch it. Marco might like it.
Yeah, I'm gonna, my final vote is either for Old or Worse or Hotbox with Knobs.
I like them both. Hotbox with Knobs definitely has a musical ring to it and seems like an ATP title. But now that I learned the boxes don't get hot, I like it less.
I mean, some of them do. Like, the shitty ones do.
Well, speaking of shitty ones, does your shit stuff get hot?
Oh, my God, yes.
See, there we go. You do have some hot boxes with knobs. All right.
So. Yeah, because it's like a, you know, it's a class AB amp. The smaller ones, like, I had one that was a class A. My God, like, even just a headphone amp that's class A gets ridiculously hot.
Yeah, that puts Hotbox with Knobs over the top. Fantastic Mr. Fox. Watch it. Watch it with the kids. It's a good kid movie. Even Declan might like it.
Heard of this.
And then you'll see where I am saying to recommend that because Hotbox features in the movie.
Isn't that a euphemism for like farting in bed? Isn't that?
Yes. I'm glad you caught that as well.
Well, that's not just Hotbox. It's
isn't it also like when you like smoke pot in the car with the windows up?
What do you call it? Dutch oven? Come on, yes. Chat room. Yep.
That's no. You're right. You're right.
Yeah. You know, we don't need to go to the chat room for fart confirmation. Casey is there with the.
Oh, when it comes to farts, I know what I'm talking about.
As a title for you.
Do farts ever stop being funny? I don't think so.
Well, because like humor is rooted in just like what makes people like uncomfortable, like it, like in a certain way, and like farts are just so against the facade that we are not animals. We are like civilized people, and then like this bad smelling gas comes out of our butts. Like that's going to be funny. Like
who'd have thunk it?
And like it's so taboo, and it makes the whole room smell bad for like 10 minutes, and so it's like. That's always going to be funny across all cultures, across all times, because we try so hard to pretend like we're not animals with butts and poop and stuff, and then this reminds us. Anyway, that's my theory on farts. Good thing we're still alive.
Good talk.
Yeah.
Good talk.
You should make an app about that. I hear they're all the rage.
Yeah, right.